this place is different, special. The others don't want to talk about it because it scares them, but we all know it. We all feel it. Do you really think all this is an accident? That we, a group of strangers, survived? Many of us with just superficial injuries? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
The island.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back.
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and my message that goes in the bottle, that goes on the raft, is to film critic for IndieWire.com, David Ehrlich.
Why?
Because I think there's lots of people in my family that I would be worried, like, would maybe their life would be easier if I just stayed on the island. But David's guilt of knowing that I was the only person he told I was on the island would drive him to get me found.
Wow. Okay. My name is Joanna Robinson, and my message in a bottle would go to my sister, Morgan Robinson.
And I'm Neil Miller, and my... Sorry, was there more there?
Well, I just had like a... I was like, should I have just said my sister's full name in the podcast? Yeah, it's fine. This is fine.
And I'm Neil Miller, and if I were sending a message in a bottle from the Lost Island, it would go to Nico, obviously. It would be all about how she's such a good dog, and how I've been hanging out with Vincent, and that I'm sorry.
We are here to talk about Exodus parts 1, 2, and 3, or if you watched it as it originally aired, parts 1, 2, and 3, as
2.1 and 2.2, I guess.
Exactly. The important thing is they are all named Exodus. They are all telling one story. It is the finale of season one of Lost here on our Lost Rewatch podcast. You could support the show by going to patreon.com/stormofspoilers. There you could also see a list of amazing content that you could get for bonuses. I'm going to make this one evergreen because I'm guessing if you're doing a rewatch of Lost with us, and we're now in seasons, you know, 4 or 5, maybe we just finished season 6 and you're going back through, you're going to want to go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers and see what sort of perks you could get to support us. We're definitely still around doing a Lost rewatch and some other things you could check out there.
Yeah, like bonus interviews with this week's amazing Storm guests, Joe Garfine and Damon Lindelof.
Are you speaking to listeners in the future?
I'm speaking to future listeners because I want to separate that. That one was for everybody. Future listeners, current listeners. But if you are listening to this podcast in the month of October or the early weeks of November, you should know we have a live show in Boulder, Colorado at the Canyon Theater at the Boulder Public Library. We're going to be talking Star Wars on November 21st. Joanna, where could people go to make sure they could sign up and get a spot at this free live show about Star Wars?
Okay, you can go directly to soslive.com. And that will take you straight to registration. So soslive.com. If you want a little bit more information before you go to soslive.com, you can go to stormpodcast.com. That's our website. Keep you updated on our latest comings and goings. You can also check out @stormpodcast on Twitter. We have a lot of updates over there as well. And if you have any questions for us about what's going on in our lives, you can email us, host@stormpodcast.com. So many ways to find out things about us and contact us. So those are some places to go. If you want to drop a review for this podcast, you can do so on iTunes. We have both a review that was dropped over on the US iTunes, and then someone emailed me directly their British review. So I will be reading one of each, this week. So, the American one, I believe, comes from Courtney Mick 22, 5 stars, love y'all. I've been following the pod since post-show recaps turned me on to your rewatch pod, and I love so many things about the pod, your banter, jokes, etc. Thank you, Courtney. My only gripe, see the 5-star rating, is how short the storm sections always seem to be. Maybe I'm way off, but I assume the vast majority of the listeners are rewatchers, 15-year-old show and all. So I wish the time spent in the calm versus the storm was flipped, or at least equal to each. The storm seems like an afterthought by the time we finally get there. The storm is the only place to do anything more than a cursory recap, so I would love more in-depth, overarching series-long discussions. Thanks, guys. Courtney, I think we're going to have plenty of storm for you at least this week, so thank you for your feedback. And then I have a British review where the reviewer gave me permission to do it in a bad Cockney accent, think Dick Van Dyke, just for the lols.
Oh, wow.
So...
this feels like a setup.
He also said, "Well, I'm off for a cup of tea with Rupert Giles and Charlie. Cheerio." So, pip pip, Christian. Thanks for the review. All right, so 5 stars. Let me see if I can get into Dick Van Dyke. "Hello, Mary Poppins, chim chim churroo." It's sort of like, I have to think of like the numbers, Australian numbers lady is sort of what Dick Van Dyke sounds like.
That's a weird way to get to Dick Van Dyke.
No, I think most British people think that Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins sounds Australian. So anyway. "Crikey, we have to go back to the island."
Bains.
I came to the, I can't do this, man, fuck. I came to the podcast after Joanna was on the Buffering the Vampire Slayer season 5 opener episode, and in 2 weeks I've rewatched season 1, the first time since the DVDs released, and listened to the podcast. Going to weekly speed for season 2 will be a challenge. A fun rewatch podcast with a structure that makes it easy for new and old watchers to enjoy. The three hosts balance well off each other and bring different points of view, though I'm worried how long episodes will be once the arc and mythology really kick in. But you know what? I'm in for it. So thanks, Christian. That's my
4 billion beans.
Shitty Australian Cockney accent just for you, bud. All right. So thank you guys for those reviews. And then one last thing I will do for us right now is read an email from a listener. Once again, you could email us at host@stormpodcast.com. And this email comes from Sarah. And she says, finale thoughts. Why did I hate season 1 Jack and Kate so much? Why don't I hate them now? From Sarah. Love the pod. Just want to share a personal revelation I had with respect to Jack and Kate. I know some people have strong negative feelings about Jack and Kate. I used to be that person, but I've noticed lately that it's probably because their characters were so overexposed in season 1. It's almost as if the show didn't have a good sense of itself as an ensemble cast, and that the network was pushing hard to have a well-defined male and female lead. I didn't hate Jack because he's a bad character, but because we saw so much of him in season 1 that I felt like he was being shoved down our throats. Coupled with that was my eagerness to know more about Locke and or about Hurley, and the B-plots on the island could have been much better. In the first season, it seemed like the writers were really pouring themselves into Jack and Kate, and that everything else was in was kind of an afterthought. Thanks for doing what you do. Hope you're back soon for season 2. So what do you
guys... I mean, I think we've talked about that before, where it's like, Kate's the protagonist of the series, and then they're like, no, you can't kill the white guy. And so they're like, oh, Jack's the protagonist of the series.
But Kate's still kind of the protagonist of the series.
Well, she has all the building blocks, and Evangeline Lilly's performance is such that it's hard for her not to. And it's weird, I think, at this point when we start to talk about Exodus, that Kate's like, you know, for old time's sake, could I go on an adventure? Because Kate's been, you know, very forward in our minds as watchers for season 1.
Yeah. So I think it gets better. I mean, not that we won't still have a lot of Jack and Kate, episodes, after this, because, we do, but I think
maybe even the next episode.
I think she's right that, that the show understands itself better as an ensemble going forward after this, and even better in some of the later seasons. Okay, a quick comment from Anne that I can't believe I didn't think of. This is just part of her email, but she says, I started thinking about two sides of the same coin, man of science, man of faith, two sides, one is black, one is white, etc., when I realized that Jack and John literally have the same name. Jack is a nickname for John. I felt so incredibly stupid when I figured this out, and while I'm not sure anyone else has pointed this out on the podcast, it now feels so incredibly obvious to me, I thought I'd write an email just so someone here at least has to read that Jack and John have the same name, and 15 years later, I finally figured it out. Thank you, Anne. I was... today years old when I realized that Jack and John have the same name. I mean, I know that Jack is a nickname for John. I just never really thought about it. So, yeah, I feel silly as well. And then the last email comes from Sarah, and she says, "Hi, Storm hosts. I think it would be fun to discuss on the show what the D&D alignments of the characters are. I see Jack as sort of a lawful good and Locke as sort of a chaotic good in the beginning of the show. And the rest of this email is a stormy, so maybe I'll revisit this in the storm. But do you have any other, like, season one calm observations, maybe for Dave specifically, because I think you've played more D&D than Neil and I have?
I'm going to put Hurley on chaotic good instead of lawful good, because I think, you know, it could still go either way, and sometimes freak out if you have numbers in the wrong order. I'm trying to think about if there's anybody that's like a strong...
Is Charlie like a chaotic neutral? Because sometimes it goes badly and sometimes it goes well, but it's always chaos with that guy.
I mean, it might still... yeah, I guess. I guess I would also put like... oh man, first season Sawyer, I think, is like a neutral evil. Like, we don't see, when we do see like good positive sides of his character, it's just like glimpses. And it's not, I think, until this episode that we really return to Sawyer as somebody that can be part of a group, and, you know, invested in as part of the Losties. But yeah, I feel like as the Jack definitely,
got one.
Oh, good. Yes.
The smoke monster is chaotic evil.
Smoke monster, smoke monster, smoke monster. Guess what we can finally say in the calm.
There's smoke.
And the hatch is lawful neutral.
The old clickety-clack.
The old clickety-clack.
It's just for smoke monster. And oh, Claire's baby is named Aaron. That's something I actually effed up in a previous episode that made it through without a beep. So if you missed me spoiling that, we found out that, yeah,
it's okay.
A lot of things.
You put about as much thought into not spoiling that as she did into naming that baby.
Get Aaron back for me. Okay.
I don't know what it means. I just said it.
I just looked up a D&D character alignment chart on Reddit for Lost, and it's like all spoilers. So we cannot talk about it.
It was really hard trying to... I swear I'm better at actually naming people's alignments than I just...
I know, it's just tough with season one only as a parameter. So, but yeah, we'll maybe talk about that more in the storm, perhaps. But
let's talk about teeth.
That's all teeth. My stuff for this episode. Let's talk about teeth.
You know, guys, I was thinking the other day, because I had a toothache, I was thinking about teeth. And I was thinking that it's probably been a while since any of these folks on the island have had a good tooth cleaning, right? But you have to assume they have some toothbrushes, but none greater than the Quip toothbrush.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. If you ask your dentist, what's the best kind of toothbrush to buy? They'll tell you it's not really about the brush, it's how you use it. That's why Quip was created by dentists and product designers to focus on what actually matters to your oral health. Healthier habits. I'm a big fan of Quip.
So whether you're on the island or on the raft or safe in Australia or Los Angeles or somewhere not involved with Lost, which is ridiculous, you need to know that Quip's sensitive vibrations have a built-in timer and guide gentle brushing for the dentist recommended 2 minutes with 30-second pulses ensuring an even clean. So those pulses tell you when to switch sides. You don't have to think, you just have to feel for the pulse. Quip automatically delivers brush heads to you every 3 months for clean new bristles right on schedule. The sleek, intuitive design is simple to use and comes with a travel cap that doubles as a mirror mount. Ooh. Mm-hmm. These thoughtful features make brushing something you actually want to do twice every day. Good habits matter to live a healthier life, so help form fresh oral health habits with Quip.
Quip starts at just $25, and you'll get your first refill free at getquip.com/storm. This is a simple way to support our show and start brushing better, but you have to get quip.com/storm to get your first refill free. Go right now to getquip, that's quip.com/storm.
Oh, yeah.
Hooray, Quip.
Neil, refresh our memory. What happened over this three-part episode of Lost on the Island?
Yeah,
do it Micro Machine Man style.
A lot happened in this episode. This entire episode, Exodus, is directed by Jack Bender and is written by Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse. It aired as a three-part event on May 18th, May 24th, and May 25th, 2005. It takes place on day 44 on the island. In flashback, we watch as the island's coolest survivors make their way to the Sydney airport. Walt annoys his dad with Power Rangers. Jack meets Anna Lucia in the airport bar. Sawyer gets banned from the country. Kate gets taunted by the marshal. Shannon rats out Saeed for being, quote, Arab and leaving his bag unintended. Unattended.
Yikes.
Charlie gets beaten up over drugs. Michael tries to give Walt away to his mother. Hurley almost misses his flight. And John Locke is carried on to flight 815. Remember when John Locke was in a wheelchair?
Oh.
On the island, the French woman, Danielle Rousseau, shows up and says that the others are coming. She says that she heard them in the whispering to her in the jungle. It's a claim bolstered by the fact that black smoke begins to rise just over the horizon, which starts our very intense journey through three episodes. John Locke, Jack, Kate, Hurley, Rousseau, and Arst, who we met last week for the first time, hike through the dark territory to the Black Rock, which is an old wooden slave ship in the middle of the jungle. More on that later. Arst blows up. Jack does some weird controlling BS with the dynamite, and they have a little run-in with the smoke monster on the way back. Elsewhere, the raft is launched, but not before a bunch of tearful goodbyes, and the goodbye that Kate and Sawyer never got to have. Good news, the raft later encounters a boat. Bad news, character actor MC Gainey is on that boat, and he's taken
Walt!
All of our good references were from the season one finale.
They really are. Still elsewhere on the island, Rousseau steals the baby, whose name is Aaron now, and tries to make a trade with the others, but they never show. Saeed and Charlie do, however, show up and rescue the baby and pick up some heroin on the way from that plane where Boone died. It all ends with a montage of everyone boarding Flight 815, the ultimate flashback crossover event. Then Jack and Locke look down a hatch hole of mystery. I would like to present, instead of a fun fact, two awards for this episode that I think are very important. Some actors, actresses that need some recognition. First, the goodest dog performance to Madison the dog for her performance as Vincent. She's an excellent swimmer. I always thought that was like a weird thing where like Vincent just like runs out after the raft and starts swimming and then goes back. I don't know. It's just like,
it does kind of stand out in the sequence because you're like, oh no. Oh, well, it means nothing.
But then it's all part of the fact that they're like waving goodbye to the raft for an extraordinarily long time because it just takes a long time for it to get far away.
I don't know. Anyway. I'm not a dog person, and that part really gets me. Like Vincent,
yeah, oh no, it's great.
Vincent going after Walt, and then Walt being like, mm-hmm. no, go back. And Shin's like, oops, I had one job.
The next award is based on an award we used to give away to Game of Thrones called the Catelyn Stark Memorial Ironic Statement Award. We are now at the point of loss where we can finally name this award the Leslie Arst Memorial Ironic Statement Award. Because at one point during this episode, Arst says to Jack, unless you want to blow up, I'm coming with you. And then he blows up. This week's opening question, true or false, this is one of the greatest TV season finales in TV history, even though it might not even be the best season finale of Lost.
True, but I just, like, having just rewatched the three-parter for, like, the millionth time this year, I keep rewatching this three-parter. The first part, X's part one, if I had to pick an hour and, like, nominate it for something, that's the hour that really, like, it's all good, but that is the hour that really gets me, because, you know, your girl Joanna loves to cry, and I cried this afternoon, and I've watched this episode so many times now. but there's, like, four places that X's part one makes me cry. So, yeah, yes, and I would select that part as the best part.
Nice.
Yeah, I would say yes, but since Joanna already has a very good argument for the first part being the strongest part, and I didn't know we were doing this, I'm going to take the third part as the strongest part. Why? Because the second part is a lot of wheel spinning, which is good, but the third part secretly hides, more setup. Well, maybe not secretly. So, like, the way massively watched, television shows, went at the time, or go now, even if you're doing, like, binge releases, is after people get to the end of, you know, whatever part they're on, there's, you know, a brief period of time, reveling in what you've seen, and then immediately begins the off season of theorizing and speculating and discussing. So I'm going to take, part three with its, many mysteries and many lines that are intended to start new mysteries that lead into what will eventually be season two. That's super powerful, and it's a great thing to do on Lost's, you know, most powerful in terms of popularity finale, I think, until the last one.
Yeah, I mean, that this is also very on brand for Dave answer. This is like the Avengers, the Avengers Age of Ultron of finales. He's like, look how many things it sets up. Love you, Dave.
Well, you know, if we survive this, we're going to have a lock problem.
Cause he's so great. Am I right?
Yeah, you couldn't see me doing the chef's kiss emoji.
Neil? Do you have a favorite part of this finale?
No, I like how it works all together.
Oh, I mean, a very Neil
part,
answer.
Yeah. Part two. Is part two where Sun and Jin have their goodbye?
No, that's part one.
Okay, that's at the end of part one. That one's just a killer moment. Like, that's just, oh
he's going to save her.
The whole season, they'd be mad at each other. Anyway,
She made him flashcards.
They all work together really well. It's weird that they released it like they did, but, you know, that it's, I think there's an extreme or sort of a comfort level that you can see the writers get into at the end of this season. And I think we've been sort of talking about it where they're not only comfortable with, they're starting to get comfortable with the characters and some of their mysteries that they want to play around with. But they're also, to me, feels like they're getting comfortable with the narratives that were around the show at the time. So there's a lot of, like, meta stuff in these three episodes. There's stuff like, Arst speaking out for the other 40 survivors or whatever.
About clicks.
About the clicks.
Yeah.
John and Hurley speculating about what's in the hatch. That was like, I remember that being like a huge thing. And when the show was like, hey, what do you think's in the hatch? Everybody's like, what? Hurley's thing where this is the show patting itself on the back a little bit, but Hurley saying, whoever named this place Dark Territory, genius. Claire not knowing what the name Aaron means feels meta to me. Cause it feels like the show going, yeah, we named the kid Aaron. It doesn't mean anything yet. Don't worry about it. And then the whole Man of Science, Man of Faith speech is just like, that is the most about the show scene in the first season that I can think of, you know, like that's just like, here's what the show's about. It's about these, you know, people having an argument about faith and science.
Here are all the times in Exodus Part 1 where I cried. This is when Sawyer tells Jack about his dad.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Actually,
right
before,
after that shot
that,
of...
Yeah, sorry, before that, when I saw Sawyer with his shirt off sweatily chopping bamboo.
I think that maybe the most leering camera shot is the one where it's from behind Sawyer, and you can see the gun sticking out of the back of his pants, and like his back is all like glistening.
Yeah.
That is... pornography.
It's a lot. So there's that. There's, oh, when everyone works together to try to get the raft on the rails, I cried.
That score is amazing.
Yes. When you realize that Michael and Jin have like a shorthand and they don't even want to work with Sawyer because they work better together, but they used to hate each other. When
Sawyer shows up with his quote, perfect mast.
Yes. When Kate is looking for Sawyer to say goodbye and can't find him. When Sawyer is looking for Kate later to say goodbye and he can't find her. When Walt gives Vincent to Shannon. When Sun and Jin
say
goodbye.
Yeah, that one's way sadder than I remember it being.
Yeah, when Sun and Jin say goodbye, I'm crying thinking about this. When Vincent tries to swim back to shore and then just like everyone on shore saying goodbye, like Shannon's face, Charlie and Saeed are so excited that it's working. Sun is freaking out and trying to hold it together. Rugby shirt girl has changed her shirt for the occasion. Like and then that score kicks in. Like I could just hear that score and I freaking lose it when the raft launches off. So it's just, it's an incredible episode of television. And Neil, Sawyer's half up hairdo. That is also a cry moment for me because it's so good looking. All right, I'm done.
I want to revisit most of those, but let's start with a question I have for Neil. Am I incorrect in thinking that we're still in helicopter shot territory of television? We are not yet drone shot territory of television.
Yeah, that's all. I mean, it's either cranes or drones at that point. Or not drones, cranes or helicopters.
Yeah, so kudos to we record some of these episodes beforehand, but last weekend for us in real time, we watched Waterworld, which managed to be one of the most expensive movies ever made, shot on water. Didn't look half as good as some of the raft stuff they pull off in this episode, especially the goodbye scene, which is a good use of Hawaii helicopter and crane shots.
Yeah, there's that one, and then there's the shot of the whole group looking up at the smoke the first time they see the smoke, which I think is a crane shot. That's another like just iconic, awesome lost shot. You get some of those where they have almost the whole cast in them. It's pretty cool.
Fantastic. Jack Bender showing off why we associate him with Lost so much.
We're crying.
As he pulls his crying. Yeah, where do we want to start here? I think there's a lot of interesting things in the flashbacks in terms of thinking about this show. Like we're saying that, or like I think Neil said, it feels like they're more comfortable with it right now. And I think a part of that must be we've approached the finish line and, you know, we're popular and, you know, people are, picking up what we're laying down in terms of mysteries and revealing our monster to be a amorphous smoke thing. So it is
that John Locke really wants to hang out with, apparently.
But then he looks like scared at one point. It's
yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. There's a lot going on with John Locke in this episode.
Yeah. Is that where we want to start? Do we want to start with Locke in the episode, or do we want to start flashback? Okay. Three entry points. We could start right off with Hatch Talk, get into Locke and Jack. We could start with Danielle showing back up, which is where this episode begins and is also her reintroduction of the plot and a reminder that there are other people on this island, which we've spent a couple episodes, you know, not really thinking about. We've had better things to worry about with poor Boone and the Beechcraft. Or we could talk about flashbacks, which I think not only do a good job of deepening character, but especially in the first hour, answering a lot of questions that we've had throughout the season. It's really that maybe we should start with that. Neil, I asked you a question about drones. Let's start with Joanna. Joanna, what parts of this season do you think or do you recall being like big gets as an audience? You got some answers about blank. If we could set aside the questions, season 1 Exodus finale does have some answers. What was the most exciting for you, if you could remember?
The most exciting thing that's answered in the finale?
Yes.
Does it have to be in a flashback?
No.
I guess, like, I think I had probably been waiting to see more people on the island. And even though we don't really see them on the island, there are people, you know, what we learned in this episode is that Rousseau heard whispering in the jungle, like, the boy, they want the boy, something like that, right? And she assumed that meant, the freshly named baby Aaron. By the end of the episode, I think we are meant to understand that that it means Walt. And, the people on the boat out on the water, want Walt. And so those seem like maybe, you know, others that we might want to keep our eye on. And that's a big exciting thing to me is like to see not just Tom Cruise's cousin, but some others on this island doing some stuff. So I think that's more interesting to me than Smoke Monster or the fact that there's a ladder in the hatch or what Aaron's name is or whatever. Yeah, I think that's my answer. What do you think, Neil?
Interesting.
Why interesting? It's the wrong answer.
Oh, no, because you listed all like these ones that are good reveals, but none of them were the reveal that I would pick, nor that I would have guessed you would have picked.
Oh, what would you have guessed that I would have picked?
We learned Sawyer's full name.
Oh, wow.
James Ford, number one.
James Ford. Okay.
James
that's
Ford.
I guess that's what I was trying to lead towards when I was talking about like the flashbacks is Jack's like, no, I'm not married anymore. Like, boom.
Sure.
Like answer for a hanging thing. We get Kate's, you know, U.S. Marshal basically talk through Kate's entire flashback story from season one linearly. So now we know how many years we're in between like each sort of thing. And we get, good old James Ford, getting real spooked out by his real name. And finally
getting banned from Australia.
But in the episode where he finally moves beyond, I think, this outcast that needs to be outcast, I think it's interesting that we finally
that
don't
it gets
have
named.
To call him Sawyer.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
I like that, too.
Yeah. That's why I thought it'd be it, because I know...
sorry. Yes, I do love Sawyer. This is...
Shirtless James Ford.
I think I didn't realize that we hadn't learned his name before this. I thought it had come up like when they were looking for, like, wouldn't Hurley have found it on the manifest? Is this really the first time we learned his name?
I was wondering that myself when I was watching it. I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, because I feel like him being spooked is one thing, but like, I don't know that it's the first time we as an audience learn his name. Is it?
Oh, that could be my notes just being too excited to hear James Ford spoken aloud.
We do learn Arse's first name, and that's exciting.
That is true.
Leslie's
good
a
old Leslie
name.
Arts. But I didn't step on Neil. Neil, do you have a favorite answer from this episode?
I kind of do. I like that the black rock turned out to be not a rock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I think the assumption was like the black rock was like a mountain somewhere or like a, you know, maybe in my mind canon, I think it was like a radio tower on top of a rock somewhere or like in a mountain. But the fact that it turned out to be a ship that creates even more mystery. Like, okay, how did a slave ship from centuries ago, or hundreds of years ago at least, have ended up miles into the jungle? And, you know, I mean, Arst has a theory, but I love that. Sorry. I just love that it was a cool, like, thing that I didn't expect. And that to me is, you know, it's good. It's a good reveal.
Yeah. I like Andy. As Lost goes forward, we will, you know, be getting more of what we've been getting all along, which is answers that also contain tons more questions.
Right.
I think, yeah, when they're finding the ship, someone's like, how is that possible? And Danielle's like, are you on the same island that I am? Mm-hmm. It's like, good old island of mystery. Yep. Jungle of mystery.
This was the episode where a lot of people started vocalizing how weird the island has been. This year of their life or these 4 days.
Rousseau has a good line when she's like, I'm sorry, you on the same island I am?
Right.
Whatever. Yeah. And then, yeah, Kate's, I saw it too, sort of to Jack when they see the smoke monster. So, yeah. This seems like the perfect place to jump to our interview with Lost blogger extraordinaire and co-founder of the nonprofit Cancer Gets Lost, Joe Garfine. We are thrilled to have on the podcast with us the co-founder of the nonprofit Cancer Gets Lost, a legend in the Lost fandom community, Joe Garfine. Joe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This is quite a treat for me.
Is it? It's a treat for us. Dave is also here, we should say. Dave.
Yes,
hi,
hello.
Dave.
Hi. Do you rewatch Lost often?
Funny, you should ask. I'm rewatching it right now as I'm building a Lost auction, and we'll get to that. But I'm about to start season 5.
So can you tell us how you first became involved in the Lost fandom? Sort of for folks who don't know about your legendary status, what is your Lost origin story?
Well, dating back to the MySpace days, pre-Facebook and Twitter, it was kind of magic in a bottle because everyone was polite and had constructive commentary. We would just toss theories back and forth on MySpace, and then friends started asking me to compile them, and I would send out email. All of a sudden, I had an email newsletter, and then a friend said to me, "Will you please just start a blog? I hear those are popular." So I did. And I had a spoiler-free deep dive theory analysis blog where I would watch the episode, have 2 cups of espresso, and stay up all night writing, post it at about 3 or 4, get a couple hours of sleep, and go to bed. And it became somewhat well-known, and it had a good reputation because it was spoiler-free. And then when I joined Facebook, I noticed some of the names from the cast and crew were following me on Facebook, and they started interacting with me because of my analysis. And I got on the good side of ABC because of the spoiler-free policy and kindness policy that I had on my blog. And long story short, the blog sort of took off, and I got invited to be on the red carpet for the season 6 premiere in Hawaii, where I got to meet the cast, go to a private cast party with the other press, and take a private tour of the Lost set.
Not too shabby, my friend.
No.
I don't think you said the name of your blog at the time.
Get Lost with Joe Pinionated.
Amazing. Amazing. Get Lost. When do you feel like you really understood kind of how bananas the Lost fandom could be?
At the end of the season 3 finale, which is, I know this is spoiler free, but there was a big reveal at the end of season 3. Mm-hmm. And I was spoiled on it, and I was very upset. Someone emailed this to me from the East Coast, and I haven't watched it yet. And I went online to discuss it, and that was sort of the first. There were a lot of aha moments, as you well know, throughout the series. But I think the end of season 3 and kicking off 4, 5, and 6, also knowing that they had negotiated an endpoint, I think the fandom and people who had theories and shared them in the community really blossomed after that.
Well, I think it's interesting. I was also part of early internet theorizing culture, except for me, it was the X-Files. So I'd be in an AOL chat room with people. I was in Denver at the time, and I would be in the AOL chat room with people on the East Coast who would be sending me things that were happening on the X-Files that I was going to watch later on. So I'm interested in those early coffee-fueled nights. When Lost becomes the sort of show that could be like a mystery show that's unlocked or bring up greater themes, what do you look for in a Lost episode that really sets off that part of your brain, that early or late night, early morning coffee part of your brain?
There is a connective tissue between the characters. One of the things I loved about season 1, but especially the 3-part finale of Exodus, is that it established a true tapestry of an interwoven connective tissue. It sort of set the table for seasons to come with Anna Lucia and Jack at the airport and Locke wheeling past Michael at the airport, Shannon and Saeed, Charlie seeing Michael in the hotel. I just feel like that made my brain explode in the best possible way, and it ignited a creativity that I wasn't aware of. Maybe I wasn't harnessing that creativity. And what I appreciate about Lost is not just that it kicked off my desire to write about it, but it inspired me to read the books that they were referencing on the show or revisit them. Even as a lit major, I hadn't read all of them. I think that it was a puzzle that didn't necessarily have the pieces all together, but I like that. I don't need answers. I don't need a puzzle that sticks together in every corner. And there's something about that show that to this day, as I'm rewatching it, it inspires me like no other.
Do you have a favorite part of the 3-part finale, like a personal favorite?
Aaron gets named, you know, Claire's son. And so I love that. We see the numbers on the hatch. Hurley tries to stop it. I love that we find out that the Black Rock is actually a ship in the middle of a jungle, which puts the polar bear to shame in terms of why is it on this island. I have to say, you know, I'm a huge fan of Hurley, and obviously Jorge Garcia is a personal friend. So I love his run through the airport.
Yes, me too.
With all of the numbers appearing, you know, naturally within the airport, I have such great joy. There's so many scenes. Well, there aren't many scenes of joy throughout Lost, but many of them are Hurley related. And so I think this is certainly one of the first ones. And honestly, from a mythology standpoint, Locke's true awakening after he encounters a smoke monster, I feel like that is such a crux and such a kickoff point for John Locke.
Yes, big fan of the jungle speech right after that, for sure.
I know you've been listening to some of the episodes of this podcast, and I also know that you know about 1,000 times more about Lost than we do. Is there a moment that you recall listening to any of our season one episodes where you were like shouting at the podcast and you were like, guys, obviously it's this, or you've got this wrong, or something like that?
No, I mean, I've listened to almost all the rewatch podcasts, and I think I yell at yours the least.
Oh,
it's a badge of honor.
It is. Yes. Well, to be fair, I think you've done your research and you knew you also are rewatching the episodes before you record. So they're a little more fresh. And honestly, with Lost, it's still a choose your own adventure. There are no right or wrong answers.
Oh, I love that attitude. Do you have like a prepared speech that you give when people sort of start saying stuff about, I don't know, the finale or unanswered mysteries or any of the other general criticisms that are thrown at Lost?
Absolutely. When I finished the series finale in 2010, I actually was at a fan event in Los Angeles with 2,000 fans, and we all watched it live and screamed and yelled and cried together. And then I went home and watched it a few times and screamed and yelled and cried alone and wrote about it. And then I had to write about it again because there was so much confusion. I would just say that I have two old 10-year-old blog posts that I stand by that I shared with you, and I'll reshare when this post comes out, when this podcast comes out, about explaining where every single person was and where they ended up when the series ended. I'm trying to remain sort of spoiler free here.
You did a good job. I heard you duck and weave there. It was good.
I definitely ducking and weaving. But also, I'm a huge fan of explaining the polar bear, which I could do if this was the spoiler section, but I have a whole speech I always give, and people had no idea it was explained so clearly.
Excellent. I'm excited for that. We'll do a little storm section with you, and you can talk to us about polar bears and explanation.
Great.
Do you remember any season one finale theories of sort of like what's in the hatch or what's going on with the boat that they encounter, any of that stuff that was circulating at the time?
I don't remember any specific theories. You know, certainly I think I remember a lot of us talking about all we got from him was, you know, we're going to have to take the boy, basically. And that's what he was known for. We learned things more about later. But we had a lot of theories that I think he had to relate to whatever was in the hatch. Maybe there was an underground system of homes, and that's probably where the lid was to get in.
Ooh, like a mole?
Yeah.
Mole town underground?
Totally. That's why they were so dirty.
Living in the mole town.
Living in mole town. I love it.
So part of like the Lost, I think, theorizing that kicks off in this finale episode is Sun and Jin, I think, bring up the first idea of purgatory. They don't call it purgatory, but they do bring up the idea that maybe everybody was being punished for their actions off the island. Do you remember that taking hold in people that needed answers about this island of mystery?
I think that at the time, a lot of us wondered why and how certain people survived, and maybe there was a reason. I don't think we could possibly guess what those reasons were, but the whole coincidence versus fate was so firmly, you know, planted in season one that I specifically remember Sun's conversation with Shannon, and she asked, do you think we're being punished for our lies? And Shannon said something like, who do you think is punishing us? And Sun said, fate. And so that always stuck with me. I think back then we really had no idea, but those long months between seasons were the reasons that these ideas germinated, and the message boards were and blogs became so prolific and were a fantastic resource for us to massage these theories in between seasons.
I know. I really do miss. I mean, we still have the thing is, we still have off seasons, obviously, between television, but I feel like we're all watching so much stuff that we don't like spend the summer off TV speculating about what's going on. The example that I bring up a lot is like, I was on the message board so hard for the Alias season one finale because the fate of Vaughn was like a question mark. And that was the summer that I went deep down, into a fandom. So, yeah, I miss that. We're all too busy, I think.
It's true.
Yeah. And then I'm curious, as much as you can weigh in a spoiler-free way, Dave has obviously been like banging the drum about whether or not Locke is a hero or a villain. In this first season alone, like, what do you feel about the characterization of Locke and where you would put him on that spectrum?
It's so challenging because we know that obviously where Locke winds up. I think season one really paints him as more of a sad, pathetic man who's quite literally lost. I don't view him as villainous. I remember being angry at some of his decisions, but then light would be shed and it just made him sort of pathetic is a strong word, but I felt sorry for John Locke. So I suppose I've never painted him as a villain in season one. And I thought he was certainly misguided and lonely as he was off island.
I mean, you know, thank you for agreeing with me and disagreeing with Dave. Yeah.
Sorry, it's a Joanna thing. Yeah,
I understand. You guys just don't go swimming in or too early and you guys won't drown on the island. That's also a Joanna thing.
Getting your identity stolen, also a Joanna thing. what was I going to ask you? Oh, okay. So another thing, obviously, that we've been talking a lot in this first season is the death of Boone Carlyle is sort of the show's first big death. Not the only, but the first big death and, sort of the character of Boone, like why you think this was the first character to go. Is there something they could have done differently with that character to make him like worth sticking around a little longer?
I thought he was not very interesting, so I wasn't surprised. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to lie.
Oh, you still don't like Shannon? Like even now in 2019 or whatever?
And I know in your podcast, you've talked about how very 2004 she is. She never made Fetch happen for me. It just didn't happen.
Fair enough.
And I think Boone was interesting, but they didn't flesh out his story enough in time.
When you have a character like Boone die, when you have an actor leave the show and the show is like so popular, I kind of feel like the other actors in this three-part finale are like really making the case for why they should stick around. They're like, don't get rid of me like you did Boone. And I feel like Maggie Grace is one of them. Like Maggie Grace is giving a lot in this finale, both with that like Walt scene, with the Saeed scene. Like I just really feel, well, okay, sorry. Fetch never happened for you. That's fine. I can stop making my case for Shannon.
It's okay. I agree that in the finale she did do some really good work.
Joe, what else do you want to tell us about this three-part finale? What else are you dying to talk about?
Like I was talking about, there are a lot of firsts. You know, the heroine was discovered on a small plane, and that is going to perhaps be something that Charlie would be interested in the following seasons. The Black Rock being a ship, like I mentioned. This is the first time Rousseau, I believe, said that the smoke monster, she described it as a security system. And that, to me, I remember that triggered my mind. Like, what the heck does that mean? In what capacity? And it sounded like chains. You had a scene in season one where Rose in the background says, that sounds familiar. And Rose is from the Bronx. So I thought it was an underground. That's why I thought there was an underground mole system of homes, is because the chains, the smoky chains, I thought maybe there was literally some kind of system where some magical smoke was just sent out and to scare people from a system of pulleys and chains beneath the mole people's homes. I swear there was a system.
I love this. This is great. This is exactly what I wanted, which is like, what were the theories at the time? What were people
talking
about?
Yeah, I'm loving mole people. Yeah, we have to lean into mole people.
But I have to say that the thing that struck me the most, besides the actual raft launch, which Giacchino's score is in it, he's a character on the show, and it was so beautiful and brings me to tears every time I watch it. The scene where Sawyer tells Jack about the run-in with his father in Sydney, it is spectacular.
Joe, you and I are like the same person about this. Uh-huh.
See, I was about to say the same thing, and that a lot of her favorite things about the finale are my favorite things about the finale as somebody who like loves speculation and spoilers. She's like picked up all the breadcrumbs that were laid down so confidently in 3X's episodes.
So she's like a Joe and Dave like hybrid in terms of like she's loving the emotion, she's loving these clues. To get some Neil representation in here, how do you feel about the friends we made along the way? That's just something Neil says.
She's also identifies with the Hurley, so that's her little bit of Neil.
There you go. There's Neil. Yeah, it's really incredible that Jack and Sawyer scene and the raft launch with the Giacchino score specifically is just like, here come the waterworks for me every single time. So,
and the cinematography, you know, as rewatching it, I'm obviously respecting and appreciating more about Lost, but the cinematography is absolutely astounding. And obviously it's Hawaii, but the way that they film certain shots at sunset or sunrise, it's just spectacular.
Absolutely.
The way Sawyer perfectly is orangely silhouetted against vertical green while he's shirtless and chopping.
The way
that was a choice.
That was a choice.
Well, I mean, you could have said Kate or Sun, but I appreciated that you said Sawyer.
It's true. Oh, yes. It's true. The way the light glistens off of his torso is a piece of beauty in this finale. Joe, can you tell us a little bit about your nonprofit, Cancer Gets Lost, and what you do with it and how our listeners can get involved?
Well, that's very kind of you to ask. Thank you. Yeah. So Cancer Gets Lost, I am the executive director and a co-founder. It is a nonprofit. We host live and online charity auctions, and we donate our proceeds to a different cancer charity with every auction. So basically, Jared Wong and I are two Lost nerds. We met at the official ABC Lost auction in 2010, and we loved it. And we realized they didn't give any money to charity that we know of. They never publicized it. And we had a brainstorm because I had a friend with cancer at the time, and I put out on my blog that I was going to sell some things on eBay and raised some money for the National Brain Tumor Society, and then Jorge Garcia read my blog, reached out, and donated a piece of Oceanic 815 and signed it. Aww. And that kicked off something spectacular, which is in 2012, we hosted an auction mostly of Lost items. J.J. Abrams donated a signed pilot script, and we have gone on to raise since 2012 $300,000 and donated every cent of it to different cancer charities. We started with Lost. We now have over 75 different TV shows on our big auctions. It's all donated by fans, writers, producers. It all takes place on social media. My wife and I actually self-fund Cancer Gets Lost, and we run it our spare time outside of our full-time job. So it's a labor of love. And in a non-John Locke way, I will say it is a destiny fulfillment for me. And it is the best possible, most rewarding project in my life. And I just want to say that we have a huge Lost auction next year to celebrate the 10-year series finale anniversary, which is bananas. We are going to do a Lost-only auction February 8th to the 15th because 8-15. It's going to be online, open to fans around the world, and it's going to benefit the Leukemia Lymphoma Society because my dad, as of right now, is a cancer-free cancer survivor. He has a very rare blood cancer. So in honor of other people out there with blood cancers, we're supporting the LLS. And the items in this auction include a pilot script signed by JJ and Damon. Michael Giacchino donated a piece of the from a later season. I'm being vague in case people don't know what that is. Mm-hmm. We have custom fan art, pops and action figures signed by the cast. Sweet Michael Emerson sent me boxes of stuff when he moved, including his screen-used green linen shirt that he wore all through season 3. And the cast and crew yearbook that Damon and Carlton gave them in season 6, we have a copy of that signed. We have the complete series Blu-ray signed by 15 of the actors, and so on and so forth. So it is incredible to have started as a regular Lost fan and to have been able to have the opportunity to build a nonprofit experience out of it and raise all the money for cancer patients all over the world, because cancer does not discriminate. It is not just Lost fans. It's human beings everywhere. And it is, we are so privileged that people like Damon and Carlton and Giacchino and the actors, no matter what projects they're moving on, they still think about Cancer Gets Lost. They have a choice of myriad important causes out there, and they still donate items to us, and we in turn give back. And that is where our catchphrase is, we have to give back.
I like that a lot. Where can people go if they want to learn more information about Cancer Gets Lost?
At Twitter, of course, at Twitter, at Cancer Gets Lost on Twitter. The website is cancergetslost.org. And you can basically find us everywhere. We're also Cancer Gets Lost on Instagram.
I also heard a rumor that there is some sort of event happening in Hawaii next year. What's going on in Hawaii next year, Joe?
There is a fan event called Lost 2020, and it is a very intimate fan event. There's only 250 tickets available, and I believe they're half gone. So get on this, Lost nerds. Basically, it is run by a wonderful woman named Kelly, and it is a fan event where we are screening the pilot episode in Kualoa next to Hurley's Golf Course. We are screening the finale in where they filmed the finale. We're touring the different sites and sets that still exist. We are doing a Cancer Gets Lost live charity auction. We have some of the cast coming. The ones that have been announced so far include Dr. Arsh, Daniel Roebuck, of course.
We don't want to explode, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my gosh. I can't wait to ask him about that. Nestor Carbonell, who is a character named Richard Alpert, for those who don't know, because this is spoiler-free.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And there are and Patchy. So, Mikhail,
played by Andrew. Oh, I love Mikhail.
Andrew Divoff. And Andrew Divoff makes his own beer. He has a brewery, so he's having a poor tasting. Ugh. And he will probably wear his outfit and his patch.
Amazing. Cannot wait.
So this is, it's in a very intimate event, and there are more surprises that they have yet to announce. But if you can join us, you can find them on Twitter, and the website is Lost2020.
Dave, is there anything else spoiler-free that you want to ask Joe?
Nope, just looking and getting my Lost 2020 tickets.
Please do.
Joe, before I hit you up for a most 2004 thing, is there anything else spoiler-free you want to bring up to us?
Spoiler-free. I would say to those watching the first time, if you haven't already, don't read anyone's theories. Don't read what you would, if you already have heard things about the finale, ignore them. Watch with a clear mind, because it will enhance your viewing experience. And then come find me when you're done and we'll chat.
And it's definitely a mole town, guys. It's definitely,
definitely a mole town.
A connecting set of tunnels and mole people on the island. All right. Joe, what is your most 2004 thing about this three-part finale of Lost?
The most 2004 thing about Exodus is Shannon calling Saeed, quote, an Arab guy at the airport.
That'll do. That'll do. Shannon.
Cringe-worthy.
Shannon really bringing the 2004. All right. So we are going to talk to you about some spoilery stuff, but that is it for the Calm and Joe. Joe, where can people find you personally on Twitter, etc.?
I am all over the internet at Joe Opinionated. So the word opinionated with a J on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook.
I'm so jealous that you have that handle.
Smoke monster. So I guess for this episode, even though we love calling it the smoke monster because that's how it is, we actually get a return to the idea that it's a security system and that it's protecting something in the island. And we also learn that like a little bit more about the Dark Territory and Rousseau's party that went crazy, because she says one of them lost an arm. And then we see Locke, almost get pulled down into a hole. I'm pretty sure that this security system is something that pulled off some dude's arm into a hole. So it makes sense that we have an area that it's protecting. How sentient is the security system? Asks me, Dave Jack Shepard Gonzalez. Neil.
We really don't know yet. I think what's interesting, though, you mentioned Danielle Rousseau, the French woman, is that she's giving us a lot of information in this episode, and some of it turns out to be right, like in this episode, but we're also still, I think, for good reason, a little bit weary of the information she's giving us. It's the whole, you know, this comes alive sort of in the Charlie and Saeed thing, where it's like, do we even know that she's telling us things that we can use, or that's true, or that's useful? And, you know, like the others aren't there at the end. Her whole theory about the baby trade was wrong. So I find it very interesting that they use Rousseau a lot in this episode, and they're giving us information that is mixed at best. So I just find that deeply fascinating.
I think it's interesting that, I have a real rough time with Charlie in this episode. Charlie wants to play like hero for Claire, right?
Spends a lot of time trying to get a gun.
And like, you know, that's like when he's bleeding into his eyeball and like, you know, he's like, patch me up, man. Send me back in. I'm not going home without the baby or whatever. Like, that's fine. But when he's just so has no empathy for Danielle, for Rousseau. He calls her pathetic, which is like what his little junkie groupie called him in his flashback. She called him pathetic. So he like, he lobs at Danielle the same thing that was lobbed at him in his flashback. And that's a lovely, like, little parallel, but it's just frustrating. And it highlights what one of the things we love about Saeed. I love the Saeed Danielle relationship. And for Saeed to be like, yeah, she stole a baby, but like, here's why. Immediately, here's why. This is a really good stretch for Saeed, of leadership. The other leaders are off doing Hatch stuff. So Saeed has a chance to shine and lead and of empathy. So, mm-hmm. You know, I think that's really,
he also shows off a ton of strength. I love the moment where Charlie like hits him and he just grabs him and he's like,
Don't do that again.
Also, like, oh shit, Saeed, yeah.
Also very important is the part where he stands under the waterfall in the cave and gets really wet.
Gets a little wet before Shannon comes up.
Yeah, you know? I just want to make sure that we all appreciate that. Also, something that I hadn't thought of, another parallel that I hadn't thought of until Dave, you brought up the name thing. And this may very well be the time when we learn Sawyer's real name. Please, Lost Fanatics, email us if that's the case. But
if not, it would have been Confidence Man, so it still stands. Go ahead.
but it's funny that he's the one, he's like reading the messages in the bottle and he's like, who's Hugo Reyes and why does he have this much money? You know what I mean? Like, he and Hurley are the two people who go by pseudonyms, and that's funny.
Speaking of Saeed and Charlie, did it bother anybody in the, seal my wounds like the soldier way scene that Saeed doesn't brush the gunpowder off of his eye before lighting it on fire? It just seemed like, for me, that would be like a minimum. Like, I know it's gonna, like, his face is gonna burst into flame and Carter has a head wound. I imagine that works. I've never tried it. But I don't know the amount that the gunpowder is going to like spark. And if you look at Charlie, he's got little gunpowder pellets like right in his eye.
Why didn't Charlie's eye get blown out? This show is bullshit.
Why?
Yeah, exactly.
maybe that's payback for punching him earlier. He's like, oh, you punched me?
I'll
get hurt your eyelid. Eye.
Take your, yeah. I'll spark in the eye. Can I ask you two very important questions that I have after this episode?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Number one, why do we think during her English lessons, Sun bothered to learn so many boating
vocab words? So many nautical terms?
Yeah. Yeah. Why does Sun know how to say fore and aft and starboard? And stuff.
Wait.
Like that?
I mean, I think I know.
Why?
Yeah. I mean, Sun does come from a very rich family. So you have to assume that at one point they had either a sailboat or a large yacht.
Mm.
South Korea is not.
She reads
landlocked.
Pirate romance fiction.
I love both of those answers. Number two, where do you think James Sawyer Ford picked up his love of Bob Marley?
Tampa.
Tampa job.
Yeah, I mean, Florida sounds about right.
Okay, fair enough. I really love
Tampa and Robert Patrick.
I really love that Michael's like, are you singing Bob Marley? He's like, no. Why are you like, what are you singing if not Bob Marley? Why are you like Bob Marley? This is like a very endearing run of episodes for Sawyer, is it not? Mm-hmm.
Most of the season.
Team Raft has a good showing all
across.
Oh
yeah. Team Raft is fantastic, but like, even before he gets on the raft, right? He's like, fuck, I broke the boat. I'll fix the boat. And then he has this scene with Jack, which I just need us to talk about the Jack and Sawyer scene, right? This is a payoff for the early in the season when we find out that Sawyer knew Christian. He does not tell Jack and everyone's like, you had a chance to be a good guy and you weren't. And they're like, don't worry. A few episodes later, we'll make it really count. And they do. And I just like, this might be in my top five lost scenes. Full stop.
Oh yeah.
Because
I mean, this to
yeah.
me, it makes the fact that Sawyer didn't get to say goodbye to Kate even sadder, in the sense that like, you watch Sawyer interact with Jack and you watch him sort of empty the chamber with his secrets to Jack. Like, here's the big secret I've been holding from you. Because we may never see each other again, like, as far as he's concerned. So then when he doesn't get to say goodbye to Kate, it's like, What was he going to tell her?
Yeah, he was going to tell her he loved her and then sailed off because that's the kind of like the sadomasochist Sawyer is.
Yeah, so it's like, oh, I'm going to go tell Jack this huge secret, but I didn't get to tell Kate this thing that I probably would have said that would have just destroyed everybody in the audience.
It is funny that by the time the raft launches, like two of those men on that raft were like, no, stay with the women. Zed Arntz, he knows about the winds.
Right. I think that like when Lost gets critiqued for being a little too dependent on daddy issues, like I can kind of see that. But in this scene is like daddy issues the scene, and it works so well, right? Because Sawyer's not only offering this information, but he's like, you know, I get it. I get about bad dads. I get all of this. We're not...
Kids are like dogs.
Yes, kids are like dogs. Oh my God. And like, we're not friends, but we are friends. Like, and all the instances that you see of people who used to be enemies being friends in this stretch of episodes is just really, really emotional and important. So, I just think that that is so great. And then you got this other really key scene later when Michael is asking like Sawyer, you know, why are you on this raft? Is this why you want to die? Because there's only two reasons. If you're a hero or you want to die, obviously, you know, and Sawyer's like, well, I ain't a hero. And I'm like, yeah, you are.
Yeah, except you for know? All the things he does in this episode that are heroic, like dive in after the thing that the rudder breaks off, go for the gun and get shot at the end of the episode.
Yeah.
Trying to save Walt.
And Jin diving in after, like, it's just, it's all a lot. So,
It's people putting their, it's funny because there's the raft storyline, which feels like it's everybody putting aside all of the drama that they've had over the last 40 some days and just working toward, let's all get rescued. Let's get this raft out there. And then the other story is Jack and Locke. And it's just all the baggage from the whole season is just piled onto their storyline.
Yeah.
So I think it works really well in balance.
I completely agree. Your question, Dave, was like, I don't know, what's the most fruitful thing we learn in a flashback? which I maybe failed to answer, but I will say that like, I'm curious if you guys have a favorite flashback. For me, it's the Hurley tries to get to the airport stuff, which like doesn't strike me as the like one long fat joke. I don't think that that's what it is. I think it's just like a really very charming interlude. It shows us like Hurley's determination, like all that sort of stuff. We get a really one of my favorite shot of the number, something you'll see in future, is that when you have Hurley episode or Hurley plots, you'll see the numbers a lot. And my favorite is this when he sort of scoots by the sports team in the airport, their jerseys are the numbers. That's my favorite, maybe my favorite use of the numbers ever in Lost. But I find that whole thing. And like, I think it's one of the longer flashbacks, and it's just really, I don't know. You're just like, oh, what a pleasant break from all the tension on this island. So that's my favorite flashback. Neil, do you have one in this episode?
I do. I really like the Jack and Ana Lucia meeting thing for a couple of reasons. One, throwing Michelle Rodriguez in at the end of the first season was like, what the hell did they just do? Like, why are we meeting this character who's obviously an actress we recognize? Like, she means something. So it's like, it's one of those things that opens a huge question. That and the fact that she reveals that she is in seat 42F, which is also one of the numbers. So, you know, that's a thing. I have a feeling we're going to see Ana Lucia again. Just a feeling.
But don't Google it.
Don't Google it.
I'm going to pick the Shannon flashback. That's right, the first Shannon flashback.
Wait,
she got one in season one.
Yep.
Yes, but the reason I'm picking that as my favorite flashback.
She's a racist.
Is because rewatching it and also bouncing off of what Joanne was saying about the Hurley flashback, rewatching it now, I was reminded that 2004 is the beginning of Americans realizing air travel is going to suck for forever. And a lot of this episode's airport flashbacks are centered around how there are places where you like have no privacy and have to like interact with assholes.
Yeah, like Arst is a bad dude. And we know this because, like you're so happy when he dies because they had to get you there really quickly, right? Like, he says, like, all this fat-shaming shit about Hart Hurley, which just sucks. And he, like, calls Rousseau Madame Nutso and, like, all this sort of stuff.
And you're like, Kate Princess.
Yeah, and you're like, die quickly, please. And he does, and it's fantastic. But the time I most like Arst is in the flashback. Well, I guess when he's helping Claire with her luggage, that's nice. But also when he's in the line and the guy's taking his laptop out of the bag, he's like, you're doing it now. And I'm like, I agree. I always think of Up in the Air when George Clooney's like, these assholes who don't know how to fly. Let me show you how you get through security really quickly. Cause I fly a lot and I have a lot of impatience with people who don't know how to do these things. Yeah. And then Dave, oh, you like Shannon's racist flashback. That's right. Okay. And so that
Shannon got a flashback in season one. Well, I think that's noticeable. I'm going to give it some credit.
Well, and it's exciting to see Boone again. Like, Boone shows up and you're like, yay, yeah. Boone.
Yay.
Oh, Spooner old Boone.
Yeah. He's trying to stop her from being an asshole.
And he has her inhaler.
I think the reason the Shannon one still kind of works, even though it's a very 2004 thing, that she does, or I guess also very too, people are probably still assholes. It doesn't matter. Anyway, it's just, I think that there is this episode, these three parts do a good job of showing us how far a lot of the characters have come from who they were.
Shannon the most, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, Shannon obviously, you know, she tried to get Saeed basically arrested because she was being an asshole. And, you know, at the end of this episode, they're like, feel pretty good about each other, all things considered. So I think that there's a lot of that works really well. The Charlie one also gave me like a sick sense of pleasure because, I do remember hating Charlie for a lot of season one. Like the Charlie episodes early on are tough. And then Charlie just getting his ass kicked in his hotel room. It's kind of funny.
Like, yeah. Why didn't you let her have some of that very large bag of heroin?
It's a long flight.
It's a long flight, I guess. And who knows? I mean, Charlie didn't know at the time that he was going to land on an island and then later find a plane full of heroin.
Right.
So, you know, in fairness to Charlie.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's good to see him get his ass kicked, though.
Can we now do maybe my favorite segment of this episode, which is going to be Australian accent roundup?
Let's do some Australian accent roundup.
Is this person really an Australian? We have four candidates here. We're going to start with the cop who banishes Sawyer from Australia. Is the cop who banishes Sawyer from Australia a real Australian, Neil?
I feel like we already met this guy.
We did. I don't think we did the, is he a real Australian though?
Dave? I think this guy's a no.
Okay. What do you think, Dave?
I'm going to say no.
No. And even he's not a real Australian. And even better than that, his name is Kevin E. West. And if you go to his page on Lostpedia, it clicks through to his official website. And if you go to Kevin E. West's official website, it says Kevin E. West, aka the Hollywood redneck. That's what he has called himself on his own website.
Don't look up his Twitter account. That's all I'm saying.
He hails from Nashville. Okay. Lily, which is Charlie's one night stand. So is Charlie's one night stand Lily a real Australian? Dave.
Yes.
Neil.
I'm going no, because if she is, then I am really in trouble here. Like, in my ability to notice real Australians.
That actress is Teresa Livingston, and she is a real Australian.
Wow. So, okay.
Dave is 2 for 2. All right. Let us go.
4 billion Banes.
Let's go to the real villain of this episode, which is the Oceanic, ticket agent, who goes, am I going to have to weigh you, dear, to Hurley? So is the Oceanic ticket agent, aka the biggest asshole in the world, is she a real Australian or no? Neil?
I think maybe yes. We're talking about the gate agent, the ticket,
ticket desk? There's the gate agent and the ticket agent.
Yeah, the ticket agent, yes. The gate agent, no.
Okay. Dave?
Oh, we're doing both?
Well, I was going to roll to the gate agent, but starting with the ticket agent. Yeah, it's okay. Starting with the ticket agent.
Okay, the ticket agent, I'm going to say no, because they're shooting that in the Hawaii airport and why...
Or no, in the Hawaii Convention Center.
Honolulu Convention Center, I think. Yeah, yeah. Either way, it's very distinctly in Hawaii, so I'm going to say no. They're just going to grab for any actress. And then I'm going to say airport gate person, also no, because I think she pops up later in the series as a not related character that is not Australian.
She does. That is a fun lost fact. Yeah, so both of them are not. So basically the only real Australian is Charlie's one-eyed stand. Who's a scrappy fighter. But here's something that really cracked me up on the gate agent, whose name is Gina on the credits, or Gina on her name tag, but Jenna in the credits, and also Jenna in the episode. So Jenna/Gina, the gate agent, who...
Did they try to phonetically do an accent? Jenna!
Gina.
Jaina lets Hurley on the plane and tells Locke he can go on if he's okay with being carried, etc. That lady is not Australian, but what's hilarious in Lossopedia is they're like, this character is probably from New Zealand, judging by her accent. Which I think is real shade at Marianne Tahini, the lady who played the gate agent in this episode. So that is another scintillating round of, is this person really Australian? Thank you all for playing. I appreciate it.
Let's go back to the island and talk about baby snatching. Charlie runs off to get Saeed when after everybody's gone to the Black Rock to blow open the hatch, and Danielle sneaks up to snatch a baby to take it to some black smoke. And then once Charlie and Saeed come up with it, catch up with her, she's alone, and we don't actually see a large group of others or anybody that would do any sort of baby raiding. Thereafter, Walt, is there some sort, Neil was implying that you can't necessarily trust Danielle. Is there rhyme or reason to the others kidnapping children, pregnant ladies? Have we seen some sort of evidence for that, this season?
Yes, but also this feels like a storm answer.
Yes,
I don't know.
No.
I don't know how to answer this beyond just saying like, yes, that does seem like a pattern that we can't discuss any further beyond what you just said, you know? Not to yes and no you, but
I mean, it seems weird because this episode specifically tries to set up like some patterns, like they're stealing babies. No, maybe they're just like after boys. But then we learn that Alex was a daughter. And that's the first.
Does she say that in this episode?
Yes.
Oh, great. Yeah.
So this
Alex is a girl.
The introduction of Alex.
The monster's made of smoke and Alex is a girl.
So I just think it's interesting that an unreliable narrator, like Neil was saying, is now become the source of answers that we believe in this island of mystery. She's the one that calls the security system. She's the one that takes us to the Black Rock. She's the one that sets up the whole black pillar of smoke is coming for the others. But all of those things seem to end up being like weird gray half-truths. And it's kind of amazing, I think, feat of writing that they're allowed to use Rousseau in this way, because if you track what she does as a character, we're not focused on her. She's not one of our losties. She's not core. So therefore, it's kind of easy to overlook that she is like plot motivator central. She shows up with the information read as like the pillar of smoke happens. She separates all of our losties. Her threat turns out not to be real at all. And we have a season break before we get to deal with those consequences.
But she's also right about enough stuff where it's super creepy. Like at the end of part three, where she's going through, I thought they wanted a child. And at that point, I'm like, okay, so she might just be sort of out there. And then when she says, they said they were coming for the boy, it starts to click that, like, oh shit, she, like, what she heard might be real, because we then see them, somebody show up and take Walt.
Well, what's interesting is that they don't cut straight, like, my memory was her saying, they said they were coming for the boy, and then, like, cut to Walt, but they don't do that. They cut to, like, mm-hmm. back to the jungle cruise. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah, anyway,
it really puts a lot of.
Go ahead,
Neil.
Oh, I was gonna say the thing is, like, we don't know if we can trust her. She shows up, she initializes the action, and everybody spends the rest of the time trying to figure out if she's telling them a story or not. And, like, some of it's right. And I think that's the thing that I took away from Rousseau at the end of season one, especially the first time around, is like, I don't know if I can trust anything she says, but she definitely heard something out there, you know, like it's becoming more real that she's not crazy about the part where there are other people, you know, like that's becoming more real. And I think that's a huge important part of her character in this episode, is like, we can kind of believe some of the stuff she's saying, but not all of it. I don't know. We'll see.
One of the biggest accusations levied at Lost for whether, you know, fair or no, is that it sets up mysteries that it doesn't pay off. And, you know, Dave said he likes part two because it sets up a lot of stuff.
Part three,
because it sets up a lot of stuff. There is so much, like, not only what is this ship doing in the middle of the jungle, but also, like, it's a slave ship, like, question mark, you know, like there's just like a lot of stuff. Some of it will be answered, some of it won't. And that's just like a cautionary tale to people who are watching for the first time, is like, some of this will be answered, some of it won't. And, you'll enjoy the show so much more if you don't worry too much about that. That's what I think.
Yeah. Don't worry about what Aaron means. Claire's not worried.
I love that.
That's such a weird, like, meta thing that I feel like you just see some frustrated Damon Lindelof writing that scene and being like, you know what? It doesn't fucking matter why his name's Aaron.
So, anyway, I think that, you were saying there's like a lot of meta things. There's also the idea that Jin introduces here, but I'm sure was part of the conversation. Of what is lost, overall, where Jin's saying that they've all been brought to the island to be punished.
Punishment versus
destiny. I have that written down to talk about in the storm, which we will talk about there. But yeah, he says it and then Sun repeats it later. I love that, like, Sun mentions it later in part three, I believe. And Shannon's like, punished for what? And we're all like, Shannon.
We're like, Shannon.
Shannon, we know why you would be punished. I'm just saying.
She's like, I didn't do anything wrong, ever.
Punished for what? Flagging a bag of an Arab? What?
All those times I cheated my brother and my stepmom out of money. Yeah.
Oops,
all those cons that I pulled.
Mm, yeah. So, you know. Yeah. Yes. So a lot of questions, maybe a few answers. We'll see. Do you guys have like a favorite line from this episode?
Well, besides the arsed one.
Right. Okay. So the arsed one that's not what I was going to flag as my favorite, but it is a classic great, line, which is, how does it go, Neil?
He's like, unless you want to blow up, I'm coming with you.
Oh, no, not that one. I thought you meant,
I know how clicks work. I'm a high school science teacher.
No, I was thinking, you got some arst on you.
Oh, yeah. The Hurley. Oh, see, and Hurley has a lot of good ones. I love the dynamic between Hurley and the group with the gang. Hurley and arst, really. I love all the interactions between Rousseau and Locke. But yeah, Hurley gets a lot of really great one-liners in this one.
My favorite one-liner is a Hurley conversation, but it's actually it's a Locke line. And when Hurley is like guessing what's in the hatch, and then Locke at one point just responds, yeah, I like Twinkies too.
I have one from the Walt and Shannon scene, but we're going to have to talk about it in the storm.
Okay, great. I also really like one line that I really, really love from this episode is, Only the thing is, we're going to have to take the boy. And
So creepy.
It's so creepy. And it's just, there's just something about the way that sentence or those sentences are constructed. Only the thing is just, I don't know why that amps up the creep factor for me. I think it's just like so casual and conversational. And it's just like,
it's almost like, you kind of get the sense, and I mentioned MC Gainey, who is the actor who gets to speak those lines. There's just something about the familiarity of him. He's so friendly, and he kind of, it's like a guy you feel like you know, and then he says that, and it's like, wait, what does he know? what's going on here?
We were mentioning before that Rousseau has the line that, you know, about the boy, and they let it, you know, wait to have that extra weight so that, you know, you click that you're in panicking, and then at some point in the actual struggle, it occurs to you that it's.
What's interesting about that scene is when I was rewatching it this afternoon, I was really looking closely. When does the mood shift here? Cause the soundtrack is hopeful, like right up until it's not, you know what I mean? I'm curious when first time watchers like get creeped out by the boat. There's one shot where the camera wants you to notice the people who are not MC Gainey, cause you know, who are behind him and look like a little less friendly. But his tone never changes. The thing is, we're going to have to take the boy. It's just so friendly
just
about
like
it.
You would say to your friend.
And they're
him.
Like,
we'll bring him back. Don't worry.
They have these huge smiles on their faces and they're like, what? It's so good. And then of course, iconic lost line. It's a toss up between you're a man of science and I'm a man of faith. And whoa!
Well, and we've also finally gotten to the Locke speech that's in the intro of our show.
Yeah, good. Took us all season. We got there. We got there.
For a purpose.
The island brought us here, Jack. That's all you need to know.
I also like, you like to, you like to play games, Locke? Absolutely. Just smiling and holding dynamite. I'm like, there's my boy.
What do we make of Jack switching the backpacks, Dave?
Dick. He's a dick.
Yeah, he's just a dick. Like I say, it's Jack's control thing. And I think this is one of the things that probably rubs people the wrong way about Jack. Not only just that we get a lot of Jack in the first season, it's that Jack is kind of a control freak. You know, the leadership styles of Jack and Locke differ in that way. Whereas like Locke he's a Sherpa. He's going to spiritually, or he's going to tie you up and goop you. those are Locke's two modes, but Jack is all control freak all the time, it seems. So that's a problem. But I do like that moment the moment where Kate is like questioning him about it. And he's like, we're going to have a Locke problem. And we get back even in this chaotic moment where we're about to blow open the show's biggest mystery and open up this hatch. Somebody's still playing the island survivor game, you know? Jack's getting his click
they're
together.
They're blowing up the hatch to hide from a like invasion of like jungle mystery forces, and Jack's still like, we're gonna have a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
I wrote survivor in my notes right there because he's like, you got my back. Like, how's our alliance still working?
Yep.
How's our click going? Are we good?
But I both agree with you, but I also think Jack is right when he says everyone wants me to be the leader until I make a decision
also
they don't like. That's true. You know?
Yeah. Another one of those sort of meta things that I felt like Jack was speaking both to Kate and the audience. It's like, hey, somebody needs to be the leader around here.
The switching backpack thing seems dumb I get why Jack wants to do it because I've spent so much time in Jack flashback mode or Jack flashback mode. But I, it doesn't make logical sense to keep putting the only doctor on the island in mortal peril for no reason.
I do like the part where they're like, let's stagger so we don't all blow up. pretty smart.
Yeah. I mean, and I love all the moments after in these episodes. There's a lot of good moments of people sort of dealing with crazy shit and then also just like dealing with grief. So like the Shannon and Walt thing where Walt is like, he helped, you know, Vincent helped me when my mom died, you can talk to him. And then the conversation that Hurley and Kate have after Ars blows up, which still has a little bit of comedy in it, but it's like, it's also Hurley dealing with the fact that he just watched somebody explode. And I really love the fact, that this show, you know, especially in the chaos of this huge finale, still takes time to deal with, you know, some of the emotional trauma that these people are experiencing on this island and deal with grief and things like that. And it's a really both sort of action packed fun episode, but it's a really human episode. And that I think is what makes it work really well.
Who gets the, Island MacGyver award in this episode? Is it Sawyer who cauterizes Charlie's wound with gunpowder?
Saeed.
Oh, sorry. Is it Saeed who cauterizes Charlie's wound with gunpowder? Or is it Charlie for inventing a baby Bjorn?
I mean, I think Saeed gets 2 points for this episode because not only does he, figure out how to seal up Charlie's face, but also the radio and radar that he made work.
Oh, yeah.
And he gets that great Sawyer quip when he's like, when you ever known that man not to fix stuff up real good or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think Saeed gets both points. Although Charlie, the baby Bjorn is one of the more useful Charlie moments of season one.
Claire's arms are getting real tired of carrying that baby.
Not 100% sure why no one thought of that yet. But
no one's helping Claire, right? Like, except for Charlie. Like, surely somebody else has spent time around babies. Or like earlier in this episode, she's like, I can't, I'm out of things. This is all a horror. I'm the only one with the baby.
Yeah, like where, okay, Arst, where are these other 40 people? Do any of them have kids? We find out later when Sawyer's reading the note that somebody misses their kids and family. Why isn't that person helping out Claire?
Yeah, the only person who helps Claire other than Charlie, who, you know, is trying to get another kiss for himself, is his son. Son, like, there's a moment when, like, son is helping Claire, who's super distraught, to the caves. Then she comes and she sits down next to Shannon and, like, tries to comfort her about Boone whilst simultaneously putting out a bowl of water for Vincent. And I was like, okay, son, I see you helping every single person on this island.
And then Claire's just like 5 feet away being dark.
Shannon had a job, which was to take care of Vincent. And son's like, let me put this water bowl out here for you.
That'll have to be something we do. Taking care of Walt.
Do we want to bleep that?
Vincent.
Sorry.
Do you want to bleep all of that? Because.
Oh. Oh.
Well then. You just heard some beeps. Apparently, season one is not the end of our trials and tribulations of trying to talk about Lost without spoiling anything. Is there any need to address calm things before we transition into interview and then Storm?
Two things. Well, I have our most 2004 poll, obviously, to do.
Oh yeah, so that's what I should be kicking to.
Clearly, but also, I don't think I mentioned this already, and I just want to make sure we point out that when it's pouring down rain in the jungle, it is bright and sunshiny on the beach. So,
it's a big island.
Just keep on watch on that.
How does a place this big never get discovered?
Climate watch. I also like that. Danielle's like, I've never seen this hatch before.
She's been there for 16 years.
I've never seen this hatch before.
Well, I mean, it was mostly buried for all that time.
Yeah, that's true.
I've never seen this hatch before. All right. Are we ready for most 2004 things or anything else we want to talk about?
Let's do it. Most 2004 thing.
I do really like one last thing. I do really like Daniel Day Kim's face when, Jin gets confronted by that guy who's like speaking Korean to him in the bathroom. And he's like, what the fuck?
Bilingual.
And those asshole white people commenting on Sun and Jin. It's good stuff. All right. So first of all, our Boone Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award, goes to, we have joint winners this week. It is Hurley and Locke. Hurley basically taking Locke down, in the fuse lighting moment. So, those are our winners of the Boone Carlisle Don't Fall Down Award. And then we've got the most 2004 thing candidates. So we have the appearance of Michelle Rodriguez, who has done a Fast and Furious movie, but is not yet the huge star of the Fast and Furious franchise. So she is in a period of time when she could show up in the end of a series of TV. And you're like, you're not like, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life. What is Vin Diesel doing here? You're like, okay, Michelle Rodriguez is here. That's curious. So Michelle Rodriguez.
But she was a big enough name at the time for it to stick out that she's in the finale of season one.
Yeah, you're like, I recognize her.
You're like, yeah, like, what's she doing here?
I saw Blue Crush. Is she still just hanging around?
She doesn't have a terrible Australian accent. What's going on here?
Is she just hanging around Hawaii still from Blue Crush? That's interesting. All right. Is it number two, Walt's Nintendo Game Boy Advance SP, which is the gaming system he's playing as his father is trying to pawn him off on his grandmother? Is it Walt watching the Power Rangers in his hotel? Or is it the triumphant return of Shannon's zigzag part? So, Michelle Rodriguez, Walt's Nintendo, the Power Rangers, or Shannon's zigzag part. Dave, what do you vote for?
Well, I want to say it's down to the two Walt things for me, and I'm going to go with the Nintendo Game Boy Advance SP because Power Rangers is still on, yo.
That's really the most famous answer.
There's two of these things that are pretty much forever. One is the Power Rangers and the other one is Michelle Rodriguez. Still a thing. So I'm going to go with the zigzag part.
Yes.
Because I knew Dave would. Although Dave, you should say the fun fact that we learned about that Game Boy before we started recording the show. And
oh yeah, it doesn't take batteries.
Right.
It has a rechargeable battery. So, Walt is, obviously just eavesdropping.
Incredible stuff from Walt. And
I love the look between Walt and Hurley.
Yes.
In that last sequence.
And
thumbs up.
And just that whole sequence, like the boarding of the plane. Great stuff. Oh yeah. Something I forgot to mention. Like number one, Josh Holloway's like, I'm going to go ahead and walk down this airplane aisle like I don't know, I'm about to murder someone. Like, this is a really weird entrance onto the plane. But you know who's missing in this?
Well, he's pretty mad. He just got banned from Australia.
It's true. Just like Johnny Depp.
It's Johnny Depp and James Ford.
Johnny Depp, his dogs, and James Ford. Do you know who's missing from this episode?
Like the character who's not there?
Rose?
Uh-huh, Rose. No Rose in this episode, which is very clear when you see Jack sit down all the way over by the window and nobody's sitting next to him. And you're like, hey, Rose goes there. Also, maybe I should have said the most 2004 thing about this episode and any episode of Lost is that there are empty seats on the airplane. I can't remember the last time I was on an airplane with empty seats. So, we don't fly that way, but
yeah, Hurley buys an extra seat next to his own at the check-in counter while the flight's already boarding.
Yeah, and like Jack gets to fly with a seat between him and Rose, which, you know, makes it easier to shoot when you're doing airplane scenes, but it's not reality, man. Yes. So that's all the comm stuff, right? We did it?
Yeah, I think so.
So that's it. That's it for the comm, but we should say before we hop into the storm, right, that we are not yet taking a hiatus. We are going to talk about Star Wars before the year is out, but we did not want to leave you hanging with that. What's in the box? Sort of like end of this episode.
We also need to go into the hatch.
So
we just need to go into the hatch.
We'll be back for season 2, episode 1, Man of Science, Man of Faith next week. So we're going to do the first 6 episodes of season 2, before we take a longer break. So we will not leave you hanging yet on Lost. Before we roll into the storm, we are so honored to welcome to the podcast executive producer of Lost, creator of The Leftovers, executive producer of HBO's upcoming Watchmen, the one, the only, Damon Lindelof. This is a great, long, juicy conversation with Damon, but there are some extra bits, some stormy bits, that you can get if you are a Patreon subscriber. So if you hop over to Patreon, subscribe, the level that gets you the bonus interviews, you can listen to everything that Damon said to us. But here is the lion's share of what he said to us right here in the com. Hello.
Hi, Joanna.
How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm good. Are you excited to talk about a show that isn't Watchmen?
Oh my God. Believe it or not, I actually am. Like, legit. I got to the point where I was like, oh, we're still talking about Lost, but now I actually kind of like talking about it again. So your timing is impeccable.
Oh, excellent. Well then let me start by asking you about this, recent 15th anniversary and the outpouring of reconsideration articles and all and rewatch podcasts and everything that's happening. Like what is the 15th anniversary? How does it feel different from the 10th anniversary or the 5th anniversary of Law?
It definitely makes me feel older. like I have a 13-year-old son. And so, everything is measured by, I literally have this kind of like rapidly evolving human being in my house. And so this sort of idea of, okay, so he was born during right around between the second and third season of Lost, and here's what was going on. And so, as he is basically entering into adolescence, so is Lost. It's just like a couple of years ahead of him. And I definitely feel, I mean, I have lots of swirling emotions surrounding the show, and it depends on what moment in time you're talking to me. But as a broad generality, the further we get away from it, the more affection I have for it. It's not like I ever hated it. But the more removed I am from the process of making it, the more good feelings I have about the show. And it feels like, and again, this is a broad generality, that's the way kind of everybody else feels too. And it's just, I know this is the thing that you're supposed to say, but it doesn't make it any less authentic because I am genuinely experiencing these emotions, which are the fact that anyone still cares about the show 15 years after it premiered, 9 years after it ended, is just like immensely gratifying. It just makes me feel really good. There's a lot of stuff to talk about in general, let alone a lot of great television to talk about. And just to be in the conversation in any way, shape, or form is wildly exciting for me as someone who spends a fair amount of the time consuming and talking about television that I have nothing to do with. So I don't know. It's pretty cool.
You were telling me when I saw you that your son was watching Lost.
My wife is basically, has decided she's jumped into her first rewatch of the show. So she only watched it, has seen each episode really one time when the show originally aired. And so, and this is my son's first time watching the show. And so they started that endeavor this summer. And they are now about midway through season 3. They just watched The Man from Tallahassee last night.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So, and it is also my first rewatch of the show. So I'm not watching every episode with them because they're just on a different schedule than I am. And they also, occasionally get annoyed when I'm in the room with them. Cause my son will turn to me and he'll say, is something scary about to happen? Or infamously when showed up, who are those people? And my wife will say, like, don't answer that question. Just let him experience the show. And I'm like, I'm not saying anything. I just want to watch. So I've kind of like floated in and out, over their binge essentially. And it's been, quite an experience.
J.J. Abrams, who helped launch the show with you, is obviously, famous for his mystery box style of storytelling, as probably best represented on this season by The Hatch. What are the best lessons you took away from that approach to storytelling that you then applied to your other work?
Another great question, and one where the honest answer is, I feel like I'm still learning that lesson. The lesson is, it's a porridge problem, which is it's either too hot or too cold, and it's almost impossible to get it just right, because ultimately we all love the excitement and titillation of a mystery, of not knowing what's going on. And ultimately I think that the big thing that we all fixate on is what's the resolution of that mystery. So if someone gets murdered, in an episode of Law and Order, like by the end of that episode of Law and Order, it's sort of resolved. You kind of know who did it. But if you apply the same, the same logic to a season of The Killing, where someone is murdered in the first episode and the resolution doesn't come until the finale, or in, you know, if I'm talking about The Killing, even into the second right. season, then you're into the more relevant, then you're into the more relevant part of the equation, which is the one that I'm struggling with, which is delayed gratification, just how long is too long, you know, and to basically, you know, string it out. Like, and I think that the basic equation is the longer you wait to resolve a mystery, the better the resolution has to be. And like, if that's the fundamental lesson to be learned, I'm still struggling with learning it, because I just think, like, I think the excitement of what's in the box is just so overwhelmingly compelling. And it's that sort of idea of like, the Christmas season, it's supposed to start in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, and it's supposed to end on the 25th when you open your presents. Like, that's the month of sort of anticipation of like, what am I going to get? Like, it can't last. It's like the pumpkin spice latte, right, which is like, don't introduce it too soon or we'll appreciate it less. Like, when it comes, we know that it's coming, but now, like, people are at, we all love pumpkin spice lattes, but we're all griping about, like, too soon, too soon, PSL. Like, it's still summertime, and you're forcing your pumpkin deliciousness upon us already. So, like, you know, it's finding that window, and people can, you know, look, I still contend that, although there are many, 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 many things that I'm proud of when it comes to Lost, the thing that I'm most proud of is that there are 121 episodes of it. Like, when we did the pilot, the only question that anybody was asking us, other than what's the monster, is, how are you going to keep this up? You know, like, what's episode 6 going to be? Let alone what's episode 13 going to be? The idea that there would be an episode 121 was well beyond anybody's wildest imagination, including mine. You know, I was like, we're never going to make it that far. Heroes came along when we were in our third season of Lost. Heroes premiered, and we just took a beating, because everybody was like, why can't you be like Heroes? Heroes resolves its mysteries. It's like, you know, like, they did it in an entire season and were super satisfied. And Heroes was canceled before Lost yeah. ended. You know, so just the fact that it kept running, you know, like, and the fact of the matter is like, we didn't know how long the race was when we started. It's like, you're running the marathon, and then when you're getting close to mile 26, an announcement comes and going like, actually, the marathon has been doubled. Attention runners, the marathon has been doubled, and so on and so forth for the duration of 6 marathons. Yeah. And so, like, just the fact that we were doing anything approaching something of quality in seasons 5 and season 6 is something I am immensely proud of. And that's not saying, like, we should just get credit for showing up, but they wanted the show to at first never end. Then when they finally agreed to an ending, their starting point in the negotiation was 10 seasons. And like, the fact that we got to end the show on our own terms, and that there's that much of it. When we look at the, you know, like, I don't have it in front of me, but like, I think that there's like maybe like 80 episodes of Breaking Bad all in, and less than 100 episodes of The Sopranos or something. Like, you know, the fact that we had to make so many of these things just to get an end date. Look, they're not all winners. We know that. Like, but I'm glad that we did it.
This will go up with the season 1 finale, and I wanted to ask you some finale specific questions starting with some of your collaborators on it. What we've been hearing from our listeners is that, you know, there are these, tear-jerking moments of the finale, especially part one, you know, and there's Sun and Jin and there's Sawyer and Jack. But then the thing that comes up a lot is the Giacchino music, the parting words music. And people just call this out as this moment that they cry every time they hear it. Do you remember giving him any sort of particular notes about what you wanted from that? Or did that just come spring wholly out of his head?
It's interesting that you asked that question, because this is one of my few very specific memories about season one, which is, by the nature of the show, I was in Hawaii a lot over the course of the filming of sort of like the first 8 or 9 episodes. But then the writing schedule got so overwhelming that Carlton and I, he came on right around the time that we were writing episode 8 or 9. Which also was simultaneously around the time that the show premiered. And from that time, I went to Hawaii very sporadically, and we divided and conquered. So I kind of stayed in the writer's room and focused on the writing and some of the editorial. And Carlton really, along with Jack Bender and Gene Higgins, but particularly Carlton was the go-between. He'd spend time in the writer's room. We would talk about the story together, and then he'd go down to Hawaii and figure out how to do all that. And so he was the one who was like, in the finale, this raft that you seem to keep wanting to destroy. Like every time they're building this thing, you find a way to destroy it. So, they've got to launch this thing. Like, we've got to get people off the island. And I was like, we're never going to be able to pull that off. Like, it's just going to look lame. And he's like, trust me, we can do this. It's going to work. So I wasn't really in Hawaii at all. And then we finished the writing of the show. And so Carlton was like, come down to Hawaii for the filming of the finale. So I went down, and we were there. I was there on the day that all that stuff that you're describing was shot. You know, the raft launch, Jack Bender was like, I'm going to get the dog to jump in the water. Like, he's going to swim after the raft. And we're like, what? Like, I was looking at this thing and I was like, this thing is not going to float. Like, we are going to kill Harold and Josh and Malcolm and Daniel. And we're going to have a massive lawsuit on our hand. And everybody's like, it's going to float. Don't worry. And so, you know, like that there's no special effects there. They're just pushing that thing into the water and off it goes. And I was just like, this is a miracle that I'm watching happen. Like, it's a beautiful thing. And so at that point in time, I think we were literally shooting the finale like the last week of April or something like that. And it was on the air 4 weeks later. And so we got back into LA. We had four editors who were all sort of swapping scenes between them, and we were cobbling this thing together as fast as humanly possible. And then we shipped off the scenes to Giacchino one at a time to basically write his music. And then he said, hey, do you want to come to the scoring stage and watch us do what we do, because you haven't been able to do that because your head's been in it all. And we're like, okay. So we went to the scoring stage, and he has, you know, conservatively speaking, it's an orchestra of like 50 or 60, union musicians. And he's up there with his conducting rod, and they project, the scene on this screen. And what's amazing is that the musicians, they are literally playing the music. They're hearing it as they play it for the first time. So he just plunks the sheet music down in front of them, and he's like, all right, we're doing the raft launch now. And they haven't even seen this thing. They just play it as they read it. And they play the entire suite, you know, from Sun and Jin saying goodbye to the raft launch itself, to the sail going up, to the dog in the water, the whole thing. And they finish, and there's just silence. And then one of the violinists starts tapping her bow on her strings, which apparently is the way that musicians applaud. And then they all started doing it. And Carlton and I were just sitting in a couch with our mouths hanging open, you know, tears streaming down our faces. Literally, you know, I'm an easy cry, but I think that, like, I was like, this is a beautiful thing that I have just witnessed. And no, we did not give Michael Giacchino any notes. I'm hard pressed to think of a single instance over the course of the entire 6 years where he wrote a cue where we were like, can you try that again? But here are some musical thoughts to improve it. Like, we gave him a sense of what we wanted it to be and whatever temp music we chose. And occasionally we'd say, like, it would be cool for this to sort of like have a theme of his own that you start kind of threading in here. Those sorts of suggestions, but no, you know, no musical notes. that was all him, and just incredible.
You mentioned Jack, and he's obviously like such a his genius on the show has like extended beyond. He did one of my favorite episodes of Game of Thrones. He's just an incredible director who can pull out emotion.
Hold the Door, is that the one you're referring to? Yeah.
Incredible, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it seems like you have this history of finding a director and making them your close collaborator. There's Jack, there's Mimi on Leftovers, there's Nicole on Watchmen. What is it about that kind of relationship, which is, you know, pretty unusual for television? What is that? Why is that relationship important to you?
I mean, I think that we're living in sort of this culture of the showrunner. People want to say that word and sort of celebrate the showrunner. And, obviously I've benefited tremendously as a result of that sort of shift, which happened kind of around the time that, you know, maybe in the late '90s, but I was certainly aware of Aaron Sorkin and David Chase and, Vince Gilligan later, but Chris Carter before that. You know, I think Lynch and Frost were the first sort of, people behind the camera when Twin Peaks came on that I was like, who's making this stuff up? Like, that fascinated me. But I think that the culture of the showrunner sort of came along with, you know, with Whedon and JJ and lots of other white dudes. It's expanded since then, fortunately. And we have, Shonda and Jill Soloway and Lena and still too many white dudes. That said, the downside of this cult of the showrunner is that very often times, you know, the director, is completely and totally sort of pushed to the side, and they are just as significant, if not equally significant, to the vision of and execution of the show. And in movies, it's very disproportionately weighed the other way, where it's like most people don't even know who wrote a movie. Like everyone's talking about Joker right now, and it's all Todd Phillips this and Todd Phillips that, and I'm sure that he has some screenwriting credit, but that was a script that probably pre-existed of Todd Phillips, and so the writer is not even a factor in the conversation. In TV, things have tilted, I think, perhaps disproportionately the other way. Certainly the way that I make television is hugely collaborative. And so Jack is someone who was a director on many episodes of Alias, and JJ introduced me to Jack, and he had the inauspicious job of sort of coming in after JJ had directed that pilot. And he essentially had to direct, you know, the next two episodes, the first two episodes of the show with basically like one quarter of the budget and one quarter of the time, and sort of maintain the same sort of cinematic quality that JJ, had established. And, you know, I think that a lot of people, myself included, and I love the pilot, and I'm not taking anything away from Tabula Rasa, but Walkabout is like the pilot for Lost. That's where it was basically like, this is how we can make an episode of this show. Like, this is how we can do it in 9 days. We can do it on budget. It can still have cinematic action. We can have boars running through the camp at night. And we can, you know, like it can look amazing, but it has this just in bravura performance by Terry O'Quinn, et cetera, et cetera. But that was the moment where, you know, where I was sort of like, oh, if we ever let Jack Bender off this show, it's going to suffer significantly. So he is every bit as huge of a part of the, you know, whatever success is being attributed to us. And this was before Carlton came in again. It was, you know, that first 6 or 7 or 8 episode run, like just massively important. And so coming into my subsequent shows with The Leftovers, we started out with Leslie Linker Glatter, but the Pete Berg directed the pilot. He was going to go off and do a movie. Leslie came on to basically do that job, but we knew that we only had her in between seasons of Homeland. And then Mimi Leader directed the fifth episode of The Leftovers. And as soon as I saw the first day of dailies, I went to New York. I was in LA. I flew to New York and I just went to Mimi and I said, please never, ever leave the show. You know, will you run the show with me? And so I get the name showrunner stuck on me, but, I'm not being immodest when I say like Jack was running Lost with Carlton and I. Mimi was running The Leftovers with me. Nikki was running Watchmen with me. Like, but in all ways, shapes, and forms. Everything that a showrunner does. Obviously, I think that the one thing that I'm doing that Mimi and Jack aren't doing is writing. But there's a lot of things that they're doing that I'm not doing. So, it's a hugely important role, and I'm a big believer in the executive producing director, in terms of sort of maintaining the, you know, the tone and the vision and the execution of the show. But they're bringing a lot more to it than just shooting the
script. Yeah, and it allows, I was talking to an actor from season two, who shall go unnamed for our listeners, and he was saying there is something to that Jack felt like he could make, had the freedom to make certain choices on the set that he didn't have to second guess or double check or whatever, that he could just make those decisions because he was empowered in that way. One of the sort of infamous stories around this first season of Lost is how you had to kind of smuggle a genre show past a network that was a little skittish to do genre. And I'm curious, by the time this smoke monster appears in the finale, do you feel like you've won and you can do anything if there's a little cloud of black smoke running through the jungle?
No, I mean, we hadn't won. Like, I think that actually the more popular the show became, the more intense that conversation became. And I don't want to spoil season two for your listeners, but that conversation about what was in the hatch, you know, and going to ABC and saying, here's what's in the hatch. That was the moment where they gave up. You know, that was the beginning of us having won the war. Because I think that there were very serious concerns about what that meant for the show and how we were going to pull it off and what it meant genre wise. Again, I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but we went and pitched Here's What's in the Hatch to Steve McPherson, who is the head of ABC. And he just sort of sat there for like what felt like 30 seconds, but was probably more like 4 or 5 seconds, which is a long time. Like, this is what 5 seconds of silence is. That's long. And so at the end of that, he basically said, like, he just held up his hands and he was like, okay, that's what he said. Like, and he was so resigned. It wasn't like, that's the most incredible pitch I've ever heard, or I have some serious issues with it. It was basically like, we've been battling, I think, about so many things up until that point, that was the moment that things started to get easier for us. But the season one finale, there, we were still, you know, we were still not entirely seen eye to eye about the genre.
At what point did you know as writers what was in the hatch?
You know, Javier Grigio Marxwatch, who wrote on seasons one and two, but also has the distinction of being in the, you know, the brain trust of five writers who were hired right after the outline got picked up. So that was Jennifer Johnson, Christian Taylor, Paul Dini, and Javi, and basically, I think Lynn Litt may have come in towards the end of that. Maybe, I can't remember. Primarily like those four and me. And I would call I was in Hawaii for every day of production of the pilot, but I would call into those guys back in LA, and we were working, building what the series pitch was going to be. And this Bible is kind of like is out there on the internet and you can find it, et cetera. But a couple of years back, Javi wrote, like a very detailed accounting of here's what happened in season one. I agree with everything that he wrote. Like, some things he writes about, I was not present for, but I would corroborate his account as being 1000% authentic. This is not a man who tells lies. And so everything that he wrote about is kind of the way that it went down. And I think that because he wasn't having severe panic attacks on a constant basis like I was. Probably a more accurate, I think that he was really emotionally involved in the show. Javi cared deeply for Lost. And I think that it's important for me to say how essential he was to what the show ended up being, particularly as a huge fan of genre and a bit of a rebel himself. But he had a lot of impact in season one, and, you know, Eddie and Adam, they came in on sort of the back half, and then they started having a significant impact. And this isn't to take anything away from other writers, but, you know, he was a real, diehard sort of evangelist for the show. He claims, and this is my memory, is that my role was that JJ pitched the hatch in the very first meeting that I ever had with JJ Abrams. Like, hey, Damon, this is JJ, JJ, this is Damon. And we started talking about how to make something out of this, idea that Lloyd had and this busted pilot that had been written called Nowhere. And we were talking about it being genre and mystery and heavily serialized and a huge ensemble. And I think that in that first meeting, I pitched the idea of the flashbacks because we had to game for the Gilligan's Island problem, which is the frustration of never leaving the island may be mitigated if we leave the island every week. Mm-hmm. And so that was my contribution. And JJ's contribution was there should be a monster and there should be a hatch. And they should spend the entire first season of the show trying to open this thing up in a variety of ways. And I was captivated, and I was like, what's inside it? And he was like, oh, I don't know. We'll figure it out. And then I was like, okay, well, we can't have them find it until we know what's inside. And so somewhere around, I think that Boone and Locke find the hatch in All the Best Cowboys Have Daddy Issues, which is actually a Javi episode. And at that point, I think, and again, you have to check his accounting. I think he basically says that I was like, okay, this is an idea for what's in the hatch. This is an idea for what I think could be interesting in there. And I'm comfortable enough with this being maybe what's in there, but we should leave ourselves space to do better. Like, if we can do better than this idea, then we should do better. But I'm now comfortable with them finding the hatch, because if they find this in there, I'd be okay with it. And the this that I pitched was in fact what was in the hatch. That's what he claims. So somewhere in the space of the break of episode 9 or 10 is when that idea was first advanced.
You mentioned sort of these regular panic attacks possibly that you're having. There's this line that Jack says in the finale when he says, everyone wants me to be the leader until I make a decision they don't like. Is there anything relatable in that for you as a first time showrunner?
Other than my strapping physique, that's the one thing that I have in common with the character of Jack. No, I mean, obviously, and I've talked about this ad nauseum, but you're asking the question, so let's get nauseated together. You know, I just lost my dad about a year and a half before we wrote The Lost Pilot. So I was processing that. And so Jack became my avatar, primarily in the idea that he was transporting his father's remains from Sydney to Los Angeles, and then the plane crashed and interrupted his grieving process. So his inability to bury his father was reflective of his inability to sort of move on, and that's one of the primary things that he was struggling with, as was I. So that was a big way that I related to him. But in terms of what was actually happening in the front story, yeah, this idea that everybody seemed... Jack did not decide to be the leader. He just came out of the jungle and he was like, I have the skill to be a doctor, and that person over there is having contractions, so I should probably go tend to her. But he never chose to do those things. They were more instinctive. And then suddenly he found himself in some form of a leadership role. But he wasn't really comfortable there. Yet he had the hubris to actually be like, but I actually want to be in charge. I don't want to be in charge. I want to be in charge. I don't want to be in charge. I want to be in charge. The push-pull of that feeling, the paradox of, please don't keep asking me to make these decisions, but I'm going to yell at you if you make the wrong decision, was very much the existence that I was having over the course of the first year of the show and beyond.
Hopefully this is a less nauseating question for you. A character that I've been surprised our listeners have kind of latched onto, which is the character of Shannon, who I think, was more of a villainous archetype, in 2004 than in 2019, when I think a lot of people have much more much more sympathy and empathy for that character. I don't know if you have any Shannon thoughts this many years later or how our reaction to that kind of character has evolved since then.
That's really interesting. And, you know, I will say, when I sort of ran down the list of actors who really impressed me, I should, you know, I mean, obviously everybody's on that list. I love all the actors on Lost, and they were cast for a very specific reason. But Ian and Maggie were both actors who were super intelligent and like really well read. And I think, like, for Maggie, I like the struggle of kind of playing someone who was presenting as the dumb blonde, for someone who had this like kind of explosive, intelligence, was probably not the most fun thing in the world for her, but she really kind of embraced that role. And I think that her relationship and connection with Naveen, the chemistry that they had, as actors was really critical in starting to kind of like figure out a way to present Shannon as more than the archetype. The whole show was always about kind of stripping away the archetypes, which is, this is what you see and this is what you think this person is, but that's not what they are at all. And the last thing that I think that we ever imagined when we were writing the pilot and breaking those first episodes was that those two would end up together. But anytime they were in scenes together or had any kind of exchange in dialogue, that there was just like this very intense and very impressive thing happening that I think elevated both performances. And this is not to say that a character has to be in a relationship with another character to captivate the audience, but it's just like, she code switched, yeah. You know, I think that the idea of like, most of the scenes that we're seeing with Shannon are with Boone, and they have this certain pre-existing dynamic, which is based on them being step siblings, but also largely based on his infatuation with her, which is not entirely reciprocated, et cetera. But I think that like there's a much more mature, deep Shannon that comes out in her relationship with Saeed. And we begin to become really engaged by their relationship. Maggie's, I think, another actor who I think that, I watch the show and I'm like, we could have done so much better, for her. But I agree with you. Like, and I think it's great that through a more modern prism, you know, a second look at Shannon as well is well deserved.
Let me start inauspiciously this way. My high school English teacher was fond of saying, three trees make a row. And so because you have Lost and The Leftovers and Watchmen, which obviously we haven't seen, but you have, to go by, what do you now know about yourself and the kind of themes that you are most interested in and preoccupied by?
Whoa. Okay. Softball.
An easy one.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing that immediately leaps to mind, so that I'm not monologuing yet again about one of your questions, is like the thing that I'm most fascinated by is origin stories. Is like what are the, if you take a nurture versus nature approach to storytelling versus like, Joanna was just born this way. Like, this is who she is, and nothing that happened to her in her early childhood or young adulthood and so on and so forth had anything to do with why she behaves and acts and makes the decisions that she makes now. I take the opposite approach, which is like, all of these things that happen to us, are part of our origin stories. And I'm really interested in sort of like exploring that idea. And my initial exposure to origin stories was in superhero stories. It's just sort of like, here's why this little boy whose parents are basically shot in front of him in this alley, this is why he becomes Batman. Here's the recipe for Batman. And it's like all over the country and all over the world, children are watching their parents get murdered in front of them, but only one of them decides to become Batman. So we have to leave the alley and start looking at other parts of his life as we begin to determine why he becomes Batman. And so that approach to storytelling, why do we do the things that we do? Why do we fall in love with the people that we fall in love with? Why do we live in the places that we live in? Why do we choose the occupations that we choose? Like, as mundane as some of those things may be, they're utterly fascinating to me as a storyteller. And I just want to know what makes people tick. Watchmen, Sunday, October 20th, HBO.
Tick, tick, tick.
sorry. Yeah, exactly. That was not meant to be a Watchmen segue, but it was sitting out there.
The door is open for it. All right, last one, and this one isn't.
My assistant is just shaking his head. My assistant is like, I can't believe you just said that.
Do you remember what material you used to make the bits of Arndt that sort of fell on top of everyone in Exodus part?
Oh, my God. what a great question. Now, you have to talk to Archie, our special effects guy. I'm pretty sure Archie was, or maybe it may have been makeup, but Bender would certainly know. They sent me, like a piece of it because I don't know what you know or what you don't know, but essentially I had a physics teacher named Dr. Leslie Arndt when I was in high school, and, he had it out for me. Like, first off, I wasn't particularly good at physics, but this guy just like, I tended to be like, my entire psyche is built around getting people to like me. Even if I don't like them, I need them to like me. And so I was kind of a teacher's pet as a result of this. But I could not get through to Dr. Arndt, who would always remind you that he was a doctor, not a mister. And at one point I came home and I was like, God, I cannot get through to this guy. And it's not like he's hard on everybody. There are kids that he likes. I just don't know what it is. And my mom says to me, well, it's probably because I came after him on Back to School Night. And I was like, what? And she was like, yeah, my mom is a teacher. And she was like, he was just really imperious and thought that he knew it all. And I raised my hand and was like, you know, and I made some comments, and then he asked me who I was, and I told him. And so I was like, oh, okay. Like, this guy has like a vendetta because my mom, like, you know, called him out on Back to School Night. Anyway, he gave me a C that I didn't feel like I deserved. And I vowed that I would one day get my vengeance. And that's what it was. I'm lost. I got to blow him up. So everybody knew this story because I had, when we published the script, I constantly was getting calls. How do you pronounce his name again? And even Dan Roebuck, who played him, like, how do I pronounce this name? Arzt. So they did send me a piece of Arndt, and it looked like it was like a piece of, you know, like it was like fake barf, you know, like that kind of like kind of plasticky, like slightly gelatinous, you know, goop.
Love it. Love a goop. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Watchmen, Sunday.
My pleasure.
October 20th, right?
Yeah.
And now's the time of the show where we thank our small council members who subscribe at the small council level at patreon.com/stormofspoilers. We have some new people this week. I would like to thank Brenda Moran, Russell Brody, Carrie Labdia, James Principale, Nell, Samantha Sherburn, and Georgia Monroe Cook. Thank you guys for joining up. And I have more thanks. These are old hats, though.
Oldies.
Small council. Oldies. thanks to Scott Karnitz, Emily, David Colley, Jen Betke, Colby Waddell, Katie Boyd, Michelle Tepper, Jason Allen, Mark Stevenson, Jimmy Luck Taylor, Brian Kerr, Shantae Gonzalez, and Claderic Mars. Thank you very much.
I would like to thank John Shen, Saran Ports, Jennifer Caldwell, Ann Vardaman, Jennifer Trice, Kristen Butterfield, Rosa, Jana Gardner, Jamie Smith, are we gonna do David G in three part harmony? David G. Not quite.
Man, all right. That is
Melissa Dearly. Jen, Carlo, Lord of Soups and Warden of the Grill, Stephen Miller, not that Stephen Miller, William Eggert, Susan Shirley, Chris Rummel, Wee Detective, Molly Callahan, Gabriel Buxo, and Pat Jukins. Thank you guys so much.
Guys, you're not going to believe this, but I also have a list of people I would like to say thank you to, including Byron Gilbert, or Gilbert, Jared Colvin, Kaisha Solomon, Jennifer Hill, Angelica Cotto, Lauren Reed, Grace O'Keefe, Jefferson Grubbs, Catherine Davis, Dickie Moe, The Ghost of Ghost, D Donuts, Robin Nystrom, Alex Payton, Joe Galena, Aaron Badillo, Lauren Bree, Amy Mother of Dragons, Breaker of Chains, Ole Ballman, and Catherine Altmaier. Thank you all very much for being part of the Small Council.
And we're back for the storm, where maybe I could answer questions and ask questions about the season one finale, Exodus of Lost. Joanna, so talking about Danielle Russo.
Don't me. wait, really quickly, if you are listening to the storm and you want more storm generally on the show, you can always email us hosts@stormpodcast.gmail.com. That's not what it is. hosts@stormpodcast.com. Yes.
Yeah, that's the one.
That's the one. hosts@stormpodcast.com. You can email us your storm questions if you want to prompt us to have more storm discussions. So that's just a thing you can do if you want to. Yeah. All right.
Let's actually start there instead of going back and just being petty about everything.
Go ahead, Dave.
What's your favorite thing you learned in this finale? No, what do you think about Russo in this episode, given that when we finally, you know, get to learn about what happened, she's basically 100% wrong about everything?
Oh, is she? I don't know. They were coming. Like, basically, what's interesting, we learn later that the Whispers are the ghosts, like the trapped ghosts on the island, right? Mm-hmm. So the trapped ghosts are trying to warn her that they're coming, that the others are coming and they're coming for the boy, right? And
yes,
so.
But there's no sickness in the Dark Territory, and it's not a security system, and they're not just blanket after babies, even though they kind of are.
It's kind of a security system, and they
are. Yeah, that's the thing about
children.
Russo is she's like kind of right about a lot of it, but only because she has such a limited knowledge base of what's going on in the island, which is weird because she's been there for like 16 years. So
I mean, her shipmates,
maybe she would have figured out some of this, but
her shipmates did get sick. Like, that is the thing
right.
that happened. I think still calling it the sickness. I mean, the sickness is one of the sloppiest things I think about the show, honestly. Cause like, I still don't really understand. And I love you, Lost. I really do. I still both don't understand and don't like what happened to Saeed. And he's like sort of Saeed and Claire, right? Are like our best example of the sickness.
Yeah.
And, I can't fully track it. Cause like Saeed kind of snaps out of it at the end. So it's like a temporary sickness. Like I think it's very messy. And like, I'm a person who doesn't really care about the mysteries of the island and like whether or not they're solved or not. But
this does feel like one that they probably would have been better off letting go.
Yeah, just let it go.
They could have stopped it here. Like,
let's
they could have been like,
forget that Danielle ever said sickness.
You know? Or it's like, oh, whatever sickness they had, they brought with them on the boat and it's not from the island, you know?
Right.
Or something like that. Or they just, I mean, they just sort of lost. My interpretation of that was that they just sort of lost it at the end.
I don't
killing each other.
Yeah, and I don't mind the explanation we get in the end about Russo's like her partner and her science friends, because that's all via Jin being stuck sort of in Rousseau's timeline.
Time period, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the stuff we see there kind of lines up and makes sense. They get like sucked into the temple, and when they come out, they're like kind of evil, and she has to like shoot her baby daddy. Like, all of that kind of works for me. It's when you rope in Saeed that it doesn't make sense to me, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So that's how I feel about that. So she's not wrong based on the information she has. She's not wrong about the sickness. She's not wrong that they are taking children, because they are. Is she wrong about the security system thing? Because like Juliet calls it that as well, right? Is Juliet wrong as well? I don't know.
I mean, neither of them know it's sentient is the thing. It's not protecting the island. It wants off the island.
But it's like, okay. Yeah, that's true.
I mean,
the temple. I thought there was a thing about the monster protecting the temple.
So there's this thing where you can summon the monster, and supposedly you summon it for protection, but you summon it at the Dharma station. And you can summon it to the temple, but it can't enter the temple because the temple's a safe space, until the line's broken, and then he can enter the temple. Not important, but it was important is like the reason Juliet sees it as a security system is because it's acting docile to Ben, who thinks he could summon it with his chamber underneath his house. But that's an act. It's the man in black fucking with everybody, thinking that they could control the black smoke.
Interesting.
I mean, they could fence it out, as far as I could tell, but like, it's not. I don't think it's actually defending the island.
So I'm reading some stuff right now about this. Apparently, Rousseau's husband Robert, I think she calls him Robert, right? Or does she call him Robert? That's silly. also describes the monster as a security system that guards the temple. It emerges from vents in the ground to attack people, though it does not always attack those it encounters. The monster is capable of lifting a grown man. And in one instance, tosses a man nearly 50 feet into the air. In another, it wraps a tendril of smoke around a man's arm, severing it. I don't know. Like, security system is maybe inaccurate, but guarding certain things feels true. No?
Maybe. I just don't remember them.
The bottom line, though, is that the smoke monster is the real antagonist of Lost, and literally no other character can be described that way.
Well, oh, now that we've met then. The real antagonist.
Well, oh, ho, ho. It's interesting that Locke thinks that he could, like, have more interactions with the smoke monster and be tested. I always wondered, like, what did he think was in that hole that he got, like, pulled through? I don't know, man. What's the, knowing what we know about the smoke monster, what's he doing in this episode?
Testing them, prodding them, scaring them, right?
So you think Locke's like straight on?
What do you mean straight on?
He's like, I was being tested when he was dragging me into that hole. You should have let me go. I was being tested.
Well, yeah, I don't know if Locke's right about him should have gone in the hole, but I think the test maybe. You know, because so the smoke monster shows up when people are under duress, right? That's sort of one of the season one rules. It's like it shows up when they're at their most vulnerable point. I found it interesting that it was just when they were carrying the dynamite back that it showed up. But yeah, like Locke might be right about being tested, but I don't know if he was really meant to go in that hole. That was maybe a bad idea.
Cause like,
did the smoke monster show up to make Jack reveal that he had the dynamite in his backpack?
Why maybe. Would he do that?
Because the Jack and Locke are about to get on a central point, and the second that Kate tries to question Jack about something, what does he turn it back onto? Are you on my team?
Maybe.
Create the division. Split up the Losties.
I mean, what is interesting is that, like, two episodes ago, Jack is like, I'm going to kill John Locke, right? And then in this episode, at the beginning, like even in last week's episode, Born to Run, and in this episode, they're working together. Like, it's the Jack and John show. We're co-leaders. We can do this stuff together, right? And then after the smoke monster appears, it's back to Jack being like, we've got a lock problem. You know what I mean? Like, so it's sowing division, which seems like something it would do.
The thing that I always, or the thing that was interesting to me this watch through is they spend a lot of time with Jack, you know, divvying out his aye-aye captain plan about how if they see or hear anything, the two people with the dynamite set their bags down and run, and everyone says yes. And then they see the smoke monster, and Jack sets his bag down, and Kate takes off running with her bag on. And I'm like, well, that's the screenwriters telling us that that's the purpose of this entire encounter.
I don't know that I agree with you, but...
Okay.
But I do like you.
Well, I guess it's a question of, like, what's the show trying to, like... What's the show doing with the smoke monster versus what the smoke monster thinks it's doing?
I mean, yes, you that's know? True. Like,
I'm
speaking from what the smoke monster is doing, because I think the show is just like, can we show them the monster now?
Here's my question to you.
Which makes sense to me, too.
Do you think that the writer's room of the show had an idea that the smoke monster had sentience here at the end of season one when they were writing this episode? Like, do you think that that's something that they were thinking of back then? Or is that something that came later?
I think just by the way the smoke moves, it looks like it's sentient, doesn't it?
A little bit. I mean, we've seen it stop. We've seen it not kill people. We've seen it, like, scan people. Or, like, do the bright light thing, which we later learn is a scan. But I guess my question is, like, I can see the way the show is using the monster to create tension. But I don't know if I am ready to associate all of that with sort of the divine plan of the Man in Black or whatever.
According to David Fury, an interview that David Fury gave, the initial plan was for the monster to represent the id, in a manner similar to the id monster from the 1956 film Forbidden Planet. I don't know that like did not stay their plan. Like if we think about, if you think about the smoke monster only appearing when people are under duress, you know, that's sort of like, if you've got like Carrie sort of thing, right? Like if you've got telekinetic power sort of thing, like it's a manifestation of your own fear and anxiety or something like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that stands with just they didn't know whether or not it was sentient. And I don't think it's important at this point these episodes, especially. It plays like a security system. Like, even in the sound design, there are things that sound like steps. There are things that sound like cranks reeling in lock, you know, like that sort of thing. They want to portray the idea that it's more machine and less sentient, which I think is also what we're supposed to think when Locke gets scared and suddenly gets attacked when he tries to approach it, you know, like all E.T.-like looking at before. It didn't work this time, I think. That's also supposed to be our surprise. Is it sentient? Is it angry? Is it testing them? So I would say, if I were to guess, and who knows if we'll ever talk to anybody that would be able to say this for sure or not. No, they don't think it's sentient at this point, but I don't think that makes our theory invalid because of what Joanna said, which is like, if this island is here to test people against good and evil anyway, the id monster showing up when it does, I still think sticks within our criteria of like a Man in Black preying on loneliness or conflict.
Yeah. I mean, do you think, okay, if we go down that road where it's like, all right, let's assume that the smoke monster at this point is sentient. What is it testing in this scene? Is it testing whether Jack will let Locke go? Like, is it testing whether Jack really will kill Locke or, you know, let him die or?
I don't see the interesting thing about.
Is it testing the fabric between the leadership of the clique?
Is it testing John's willingness to just give himself over to the island?
Yeah, that's also possible.
Like, it's a test of faith, right? Like, that's what it has to be. That's like, that's a biblical thing.
Well, in Locke's mind, for sure.
Well, right. But that's like the sort of the biblical thing. Like, that's what a test usually is. We've got a character named Aaron in this episode, but like this test of faith, like, okay, if you consider yourself a man of faith, giving yourself over to whatever the island needs, let me test that by dragging your ass into a hole. Is will your faith withstand that? I mean, that's a possibility, you know.
Well, not only that, but will
Jack allow that to happen, I think is good, because
already
he knows that he needs to attack Jack through Ghost Dad. Like, that's the more valuable way to make Jack crack, but to find the borders of what Locke is willing to let him do, especially right on the cusp of the hatch, because I don't really remember the Man in Black taking a firm stance on the happenings of the hatch. It doesn't seem like that makes any difference to him in terms, I mean, it's access to the energy and it's man using the energy, which he's not against in any other way, but I don't think it affects his journey of trying to get off the island. So we're about to take a little detour in his interests, even though I think Locke might,
I don't know,
somewhat still be influenced.
Isn't Desmond, like, Desmond feels important to the Man in Black's plan to get off the island, right? Why do they draw Desmond to the island?
Because he can interact with, like, the Force. I don't know if Desmond's important to the Man in Black. Desmond's definitely important to Jacob.
Okay. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to the Man in Black if he liberates Desmond from the hatch. Or maybe, like, he's important. If he's important to Jacob, then maybe it's important to the Man in Black to, like, ruin Jacob's, like, need for Desmond. Get him out of there. Something like that. You know?
Yeah, because until they blow open the hatch, Desmond is doing pretty good pressing those buttons.
Working out, listening to music.
Yep. Not thinking too much about Penny, I guess.
Reading Charles Dickens. It's all good times down the hatch.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see as we go into season two if we're able to keep tracking the Man in Black. At least here at the tail end of season one, I'd stick with what I said at the pilot. Everything. Locke was the antagonist, and the Man in Black through Smoke Monster used him to bend the will of the Losties. It's there enough for me. Granted, now we're at the end of season one. If you guys don't agree with me, you have a ton of, like, first hand, you guys being the listeners, not Joanna and Neil, who could disagree with me whenever they want, and did, I think, the first time. But I think, there's a lot of evidence for your own reading on what the huge meta narrative of season one is, given a 6-season scope where it's like season one's really good at what's going on with the Losties, but in terms of what's going on with the meta narrative of the island, vague. That's okay. It's not like part of the scrum yet.
Yeah, we got time.
I think what's interesting is that we get enough of Kate and the Smoke Monster in season one, that then does not, I think, wind up paying off in the end. Like, the Smoke Monster's interest in Kate. Like, I think the Smoke Monster becomes the most interested in Jack and in John. But I think, you know, I think the show itself, like, their original idea was to have Kate be the protagonist. Then she was replaced by Jack. And then eventually, like, I think the show loses its ability to really dig into Kate that way, you know? Mm-hmm. She becomes Aaron's mom. I like a lot of the stuff that happens with Kate's narrative around Aaron and stuff like that, but it's not tied to the island. The island loses interest in her when she becomes a mother, but then the show sort of loses interest in her significance there. You know what I mean? It's interesting. Mm-hmm.
And I think we're about to see, you know, the influx of new characters that we get at the beginning of season one, or at the beginning of season two, sorry, sort of into that early part of season two. The show really does, it feels like there's a lot of reshuffling that they have to do. Which some of it works and some of it doesn't.
I think it's so fascinating that they introduced Michelle Rodriguez in part one. Yeah. In part one, they
and then never come back to it. Like, until what? Isn't it 3 or 4 episodes later?
I think it's like episode 3 or something like that. But like
the other 48 days, I think, is the one.
No, I mean, that's like the Tailies one, but when do we see Michelle Rodriguez again? Not until like, what, season 2, episode 3?
Yeah, she pops up at the end of something.
You know, when they're like in the pit, the tiger pit and stuff like that. But
in the pit.
Right. Because there's the whole Mr. Echo capturing them, or her and Mr. Echo capturing.
Right. They have the Tailie set up in this season, but they don't
set up. Which is wild.
But they don't set up Desmond. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like if I had to guess, not knowing anything, about like what are they going to drop in season one, I would drop like a Desmond in a flashback before I put Michelle Rodriguez in that airport bar. Or, you know what I mean?
Even the corporation, since they're going to go right into
Dharma stuff.
Dharma next season. Yeah. But and they knew the corporation because they were calling it the Hydra Corporation in the writers' room.
Right.
At this point, so they knew that point, but they don't drop anything about that.
Yeah, I think it's almost a really interesting fake out to have to pop Michelle Rodriguez in there, and then to have, you know, the way that the next episode starts with Desmond is like completely disorienting and wonderful. And I think that it's a great fake out in the sense that if you were looking for the answer to who's in the hatch and you were going to dig through like crazy, you might have thought it was Michelle Rodriguez.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah.
You know, I think that goes to the, like we've been talking about, the confidence that the show started to get, not only with the characters and their own stories, but with the way the show was received. So it almost felt like, yeah, like they were throwing that in there to throw people off. Otherwise, yeah, why the hell?
No, there's a great, yeah, that's this, the Exodus is great at that, because that's also the scene where Jack, you know, like lays out the realities of his marriage. So then there's also like that weird itch in the back of your brain where it's like, did they just waste Michelle? Did they just like executive decision Steven Seagal, Michelle Rodriguez, just so we could learn about Jack's marriage status? Like they needed somebody.
Yeah, it's easy to believe until she says that she's in seat 42F. And it's like, numbers.
But in the episode that we have stuff like, you know, Art's talking about clicks, that could be like a Lost was the most popular show on television and they got like a weird cameo to blow up in the back end of the plane.
Yeah.
Well, and we know they wanted to do it in the pilot. They wanted to stunt cast Jack.
Yeah. So it could have been that.
Yeah, I guess. I wonder if this is even remotely true, the whole throwing people off about the hatch thing. Cause there, I do remember being sort of keying in on like, not only what's in the hatch, but who's in the hatch. Because I feel like you believe that someone was in the hatch and like, there's no way they're going to open this thing.
Cause we saw a light turn on, right? And it did.
Exactly.
That seemed like,
so it's like, who's in there?
That. Yeah.
I want to believe, and our listeners, Storm listeners, if you have memories of this, email us, hosts@stormpodcast.com. But did you think that Michelle Rodriguez might be in the hatch?
Ooh, who else could it have been? Let's pretend we're watching Exodus. Reanimated Jack's dad.
Jack's dad, for sure.
Rose. Mom. Rose.
Rose, yeah.
Rose's husband.
Rose's husband. Yes, absolutely.
Whoever was on that plane. No, those guys are dead.
Yeah. What was Claire's attempted baby daddy?
What about Alex? Is Alex in the
Alex,
hatch?
Yeah, Alex?
Alex.
Oh, Alex in the hatch.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Russo's like, I've never seen this hatch before. It's her daughter.
Yeah. Because there's no clue in this episode that we're getting Desmond. Like, the Desmond thing comes out of nowhere.
Zero.
And it's amazing.
Yeah.
So if you think about to the mindset of where people were back in May of 2005, they were probably reaching for who and what is in the hatch.
Real Sawyer.
Sawyer.
Locke's dad.
Locke's dad.
Locke's mom. That'd be even weirder.
Son's dad.
The guy in the Hawaiian shirt who speaks Korean.
Oh, that psychic who scared Claire.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of fun.
Gina? That's hard to say. I don't know.
That shitty ticket agent. Anyway, this isn't necessarily Storm Talk. This is more, Calm Talk, but, we didn't like run down what happened at the Emmys for Lost in season one.
Oh, right.
They were nominated for 12. They won 6, which is outstanding casting. Okay. Outstanding directing. That's a biggie. Outstanding drama series. The big one. They won it. Music composition for Giacchino. And then single camera picture editing and then visual effects. And then Terry O'Quinn and Naveen were nominated for supporting. And then they got a bunch of writing nominations as well. And it was nominated for Golden Globe, Best Television Series Drama. But like the fact that like, I'm trying to remember the last time, well, I'm sure it's happened recently and I host an award season podcast, so don't judge me, but like, a show getting best drama for its first season is, pretty crazy.
It's It's more rare. And I think
And for a genre show.
Sure. Especially because by this time,
Yeah.
Secret genre show.
I think it really is that it's got such strong bookends with the pilot and the finale. Like it's hard to watch this season and not, and even the stuff in the middle that drags a little bit, it's hard to watch this and not go, this is one of the best seasons of television, like, period.
Yeah. Huge montage where they're all getting on the plane at the end. I'm like, this is a weird way. Cause like, I know that I'm going to go through a ton more and understand these characters.
I know
characters.
There's five more seasons of this show.
Yeah. But in terms of like encapsulating these 25 episodes, 26 episodes, it's just really great, how it like pulls off, both sides of, I think, destiny and, like happenstance, science and faith, in terms of how like these people got thrown together into a survivor situation and, sort of all ended up liking each other, except Joanna, who shouldn't have gone swimming that early in the morning.
Oh, and Steve and or Scott. and Boone. For perspective, other shows that have won, this Emmy Award in their first season, Handmaid's Tale, obviously that was like a big, like, sort of phenomenon sort of situation. Homeland in its first season and, Mad Men and West Wing. But like, it's not, it usually like.
I mean, those are all good shows that had fairly strong first seasons. In
absolutely.
The case of Homeland, maybe the only good.
The season. Only, yeah. But, yeah, and but the, usually
those
are all
you shows
have to
that
like,
were like
yeah.
the thing, you know?
Exactly.
They were the big thing of the moment.
Exactly. And there wasn't like another big thing that they was like competing up against and stuff like that.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Not in their first seasons, you know, like Mad Men later, but not early on. That show was train. It was just a freight train of good.
All right, I have a question, a storm question for my hosts that have watched the whole season more recently, or the whole series more recently than I have. How in danger are Team Raft to scrambling their own brains, sailing the wrong vector away from the island?
Ooh, yeah, that's not a thing that they were worried about then. Oh, it could have gotten full Minkowski.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
There's that. There's Locke points out that the slave ship is from like Mozambique. Mm-hmm. I think it ends up being from there. I think it's from a slightly north than that. Some sort of like Rock of Gibraltar area sort of thing. I don't know. I don't remember. But that's not until Abiturno. So they just decide to like write that off as like vague slave ship and then don't worry about what color the slaves were.
It sets off
from Portsmouth on a training mission to the Kingdom of Siam, now known as Thailand.
All right, good. So definitely Locke was wrong.
No, but Locke is theorizing that the ship is en route to a mining colony probably set off from the eastern coast of Africa, Mozambique. Locke, like, that's such a specific guess. Such a weird, specific guess.
That's so, like I read it in a magazine guess. Like, I read a story in a magazine about these pirate ships, or these slave ships that came from Mozambique, of all places.
And Richard came from the Canary Islands. So that's how Richard got on board.
Mm-hmm.
There we go. Yeah. So it just seems like, saying that and then being like, we're gonna have to deal with it, and then getting to season six and being like, oh no, we never dealt with
it. Does feel like one of those things where, and I will obviously have a lot of time to talk about this, but where they get into explaining things that didn't really need to be explained, and they start over explaining at the end there. This might be one of them. This is a candidate at least.
Well, yeah, I don't mind that Richard got there on the Black Rock like that. And I like that we see him in the chains and stuff like that. Like, I think that's cool. But I think that, yeah, the Canary Islands are very far from Mozambique. just looking at a good old Google Earth there. The sickness bothers me more. The Black Rock, I mean, I kind of like that we find out that it has to do with Richard. Cause that's like, that, those are, that's like one of those efficiencies of storytelling things. You know how like on Game of Thrones, they're like, oh, we need a girl to be raped. Why not Sansa? And you're like, but they're like, oh, we need a backstory for Richard and explain how the Black Rock get here. Two great tastes that taste great together. You know, like it, that works for me. So,
Richard's eyeliner and a ship full of dynamite. It's actually not eyeliner. He just looks like that.
Mr.
Carbonell.
Tied to a hold in a ship full of dynamite.
Ship full of dynamite.
Yeah, no, it does start. Okay. So I've watched a video. I mean, we're in the storm and this is our supersized episode. So I'm just going to randomly say this. I've watched a video of Nestor Carbonell taking, who plays Richard Alpert, who we've not met yet on the show, taking like a wet wipe to his eye to prove that he's not wearing eyeliner, and I still don't believe him.
Yeah, it came up a lot, not only around Lost, but not long after he played the mayor in The Dark Knight, and everybody was like, this guy's got eyeliner on.
Apparently not. I always think of him either as Batman Well, or yes. He was on the NBC sitcom Suddenly Susan, where the accent that he used on that was like, very thick and like, I don't, probably not accurate, but he would call the character of Susan, played by Brooke Shields, Shushan. He's like, oh, Shushan. Anyway, my friends and I made fun of that a lot. Suddenly Shushan.
So that's Richard. We'll meet him in a couple seasons.
Richard.
Actually, no, he's in season two.
Is right? He?
Yeah, he recruits Juliet. To come to Portland.
That sounds right.
I just watched it. I promise.
I believe you.
Yeah. He's the guy who gets Juliet to come work for the Dharma initiative. Yeah.
The Dharma season. We're coming up finally on an occasion for me to buy a jumpsuit.
Well, can we talk about, let us talk about this thing that Jin says and that Sun repeats, which is like, do you think we're being punished?
The purgatory theory.
The purgatory theory. And it's like, they were dead the whole time. They're in purgatory. Yeah, the writers are annoyed that that is a prevailing theory about Lost, but definitely they put the bait on the hook, with that,
Jin and they Sun did, stuff, although I would argue that taking it all the way to purgatory is taking it a little too far. Because the conversation that they're having in the episode is around faith and science. And it's just to me another form of believing that it's your destiny to end up on the island and be punished. This is something I sort of specifically remember from watching season one the first time around was, I was always confused by the purgatory thing. Cause I was like, guys, like they just believe that like bad shit's happening to them because they were terrible people or because they lied. I don't ever get the sense from the show itself or from the characters' mouths that anyone thinks they're in purgatory. This may change by the time we get to season six, but, it's just like Jin believes that he's being punished because of all the stuff that he did to Sun and that one guy. And, Sun believes she's being punished because she lied.
Point of order, just so we don't get any emails. Juliet does not show up on the show until season three.
Oh, sorry.
her first episode is her flashback is episode seven. So I think Richard shows up the first time in season three.
Season three, episode seven. Yeah. All right. Well, then I amend it to whenever Juliet shows up.
Yeah, that's when we know. Richard for the first time. I was going to say, like, at this point, I've been watching along with this rewatch. So I'm about to start, season two and Neil would have just taken you at your word there and been like, man, there's a lot about season two. I don't remember if Juliet's already showing up.
I think this is just illustrative of how season two and season three sort of run together. Or at least the first like half of season three. So it sort of run. It feels like it's a part
Neil,
of season
Neil
two
is just making his own kind of music. You know, he's just singing his own kind of song. See, there.
Yeah. So. Even if nobody else plays along.
Even if the facts don't. It's fine. Yeah,
so but I was right about the Juliet thing. I just forgot the timeline.
You were right. You were right about that. All right. So do you want to talk about the why stealing children thing in the storm? I mean, I don't know. It just feels like something that I couldn't answer in the comm, but like, you know, we know that they take kids because There's a fertility problem on the island. I mean, the reason that they take Walt is he's on the list, right? That's the reason they took the kids from the Taileys, right?
I believe so, yeah. And then also Alex, or does Danielle. So I don't think the others actually are taking kids. I think that's something that developed. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think they're like, here's my question about the others. Here's my question about the others. Is like them taking people who are on the list. Is the list real?
I think the lists are real.
Or did Ben invent the list?
Well, okay. The concept of lists are real. I don't know if all of the lists are real.
So if the lists are real, why don't
they just
like... Because
Ben would definitely like make some for his own fucking nefarious purposes. But I do think Ben gets lists from Richard, yes.
If the others are not evil, which is like eventually kind of what we're led to believe, why don't they like take someone who's a candidate, test them, and then if they're not the one we want, put them back? You know what I mean? Like, why do they kill some people? Why do they raise some other people? Like, I don't think I really understand that, you know?
So they're supposed to be acting on behalf of Jacob.
Right.
But then Richard got sort of subservient to Ben, who perverts everything. So Ben's the one that's like keeping people in weird little book club villages and, you know, like running his little power games all over the island. That's not Jacob, who is in theory bringing people to be tested, bringing candidates to be tested. But I don't think Ben wants Ben wants to be the candidate.
So he would rather just eliminate the competition.
I think he's like super evil. I mean, we're going to have to spend a lot, like, a bunch of
Ben's
seasons with
the
him.
Real villain.
It teams up with Locke. Yeah, at least that's my recollection of it, is that Ben is like this very traumatized child who is basically told he could meet God. He just has to be patient, and he fails at that test of patience and becomes this little island despot. Fighting against Widmore and whatnot.
Yeah, I guess I just don't understand. So a list that Ben gives of people for them to take from the Tailey crash, and it's like not Anna Lucia, but yes, the children. Like yes, Cindy, not Libby, or like whatever it is, you know, right? Yeah.
And not Bernard.
Not Bernard, but. I just remember Cindy and the kids. And then Cindy is just like another now, and then they raise the kids as others. And would they have kept Walt forever as another, or is Walt a different thing because he actually has powers?
I feel that that's the difference between like becoming an other and being a candidate. I'm sure Walt's a candidate. I think Cindy and the others like are candidates to become, they're Richards.
All right. I guess I don't understand the difference between Jacob's candidates and a list of people to like abduct and keep.
I think Ben being the only person knowing the difference between Jacob's real list and the ones of people he's just abducting would be the person that would be dictating that. Jacob wants candidates, doesn't give a shit about making more others. At some point, Richard became the Moses of a group of others that also needs to be added to.
Right, so they need to replenish their other supply, and since they can't make new babies, they steal other people's children? That seems like a very evil thing to do, right?
A little bit, but then also the island, like, helps. Lured Juliet to do, so it's like the kids from Never Neverland, I guess.
I guess, it's just like, Richard doesn't seem evil. Like, I think you're supposed to think that Richard isn't evil. And then why would he kidnap children if he wasn't evil, you know?
Well, I mean, I think like Ben's the one directing the kidnapping. Like Richard seems like the kind of person that would give everyone a choice. He gives young Ben a choice. But then at some point he gets under Ben's thumb when, you know, probably when he sees the Dharma Initiative.
Why is Richard under Ben's thumb? I understand why he gets like confused about Locke. He gets confused about Locke because of time travel. And I love that Richard's like, I kept testing him. And guess what? He's not special. But like, I don't understand how Richard, like, why would Richard, an eternal being who at a certain point reported directly to Jacob, like, why would he believe Ben when he lies to him?
I don't recall a good answer to that.
Well, this will be, sorry, I think we maybe got a little bit in the weeds, which is something we promised we wouldn't do so much on the storm. Yeah.
You promised more storm, and this is what I want to talk
yeah.
about.
No, no, I'm not saying it's your fault. I sort of got us here as well, I think. So, Neil, is there storm stuff you want to talk about specifically in this episode or widely in the series?
No, I feel like we've covered a lot of the stuff that I wanted to talk about. Most of my storm thoughts are like what happens immediately next. So it's like the Desmond stuff, Shannon. I guess. Yep. Taylor's is sort yeah, of
Shannon's
like
no
the next
bad,
big thing.
No good, bad, horrible week and a half.
Yeah, and also I think that season two really does kick into high gear with the Locke and Jack dynamic, especially over the stuff in the hatch. So I'm interested to see how you know. How
rewatching
much we get with that.
Rewatching these final three episodes, I'm particularly pissed about what happens to Shannon because. I honestly think that Maggie Grace saw Ian Somerhalder get killed off and was like, I need to make Shannon very good if I want to stay on right. the show. And she's very good in these final three episodes. I mean, Maggie Grace is always good, but like the amount of like pathos and emotion that Maggie Grace is like dredging up from her, like the bottom of her toes, in these final episodes, I'm like, she's making the case for mm-hmm. Shannon should stick around. And they're like, nah.
Well, that's almost what makes the what happens to Shannon ultimately so powerful is it really does feel like she sort of turns this corner and becomes a really integral part of the, you know, team, and her and Saeed are getting along well, and then it's like random just dead. So great.
Oh, Shannon. You got a flashback though. Both Shannon and Walt got a flashback this episode and will not have any going forward. Last Shannon, last Walt flashbacks, rest in peace.
Now they just get to have weird supernatural conversations with each other.
Mm-hmm. Super fun. Great. Let's, right before we jump off, just a reminder, we're going to start season two next week. What are you guys most looking forward to in season two? Neil, you did list off some things. Is there anything else you're super looking forward to in season two?
I'm looking forward to everyone, not just me, this week, but everyone is going to have that song stuck in their head. Make your own kind of music. You know.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite, songs of Lost. One of my favorite uses of songs. It's great.
Joanna, how about you?
Mr. Echo.
Mr. Echo.
I love Mr.
All time faves.
Yeah, I love Mr. Echo. And like I love his introduction. Like I think his introduction, like you see Jin come like running out of the jungle, right? With his hands mm-hmm. tied, and you're like, shit. And then you know, they're doing stuff, and then like Echo's just there with his stick, and you're like, what the fuck? And it's great. I love Mr. Echo. So I'm yeah. really excited for him to show.
I really love the way that they roll out the new characters.
The like, Taillys?
Not all yeah. the Taillys work, but they roll them out in such a way that it's really interesting, because at first you don't know. You know, you kind of maybe think they're others, because we're in others panic right now. So it's going to be great.
And then, of course, I mean, it's not that early in season two that we get it. But I mean, Lost isn't Lost until Ben Linus is here, is my opinion. So I'm really excited for Ben Linus and Desmond in his blue shirt.
Really excited to be able to talk about Ben Linus in The Calm.
Yes. Yeah.
But we won't. We'll have. It's gonna it will take a while.
Like the whole season.
Right. It's going to be like
Henry Gale in The Calm.
Boy, this character actor really was from a period of that time in television, and I wonder if he did anything else. Oh, he did that show about a computer that learned anything, and nothing in between. We don't know.
I called MC Gainey's character Friendly a bunch of times.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I definitely noticed.
But I only realized it after the second time that I said that I was like, oh, and then I'm just going to keep doing this. So it's not like I didn't. It was not on purpose initially, is my
point. Oh, because so. the first time you had like a purposeful pause where you're like Friendly, and I'm like, you sly no. host.
No.
My favorite upcoming thing for season two is Dharma orientation films. Love all those Dharma orientation films. Love
and all
those
the weird
lore drops.
Cuts. Yep. Mm-hmm. All the frames that are missing.
Love it. That's also I was rewatching some Venture Brothers the other day, and they do like that whole like orientation film like spoofing thing, and love it. Love some good
love a good orientation film.
We have a big overlap between our listenership and like the Expanse fans. So Francois Chow, who plays Dr. Pierre Chang, is also mm-hmm. Jules Pierre Mao. Jules Pierre Mao on The Expanse. So I'm excited for them to be like, oh my god, it's Mao. That's amazing.
When I'm like, oh my god, it's Miles' dad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hold on, guys. He'll be
better
around.
Character coming down the pipe.
All right. Guys, I think that was season one of Lost. We did it. We rewatched season one of Lost. All right, until next week, where we'll be taking on
Desmond,
and check out what's in the hatch. Where can people find more of your work online? Let's start this week with Joanna Robinson.
You can find me on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Marvin Candle, and you can hear me. That's a Lost joke, guys. You can hear me on the podcast in the Boiler Room, still watching Loud Noises in Oakland, California, and Little Gold Men.
Joanna just makes a joke and revs the fuck out. Podcast over. And Mr. Neil Miller.
Well, you know, you can always get me sitting there in my favorite chair enjoying a McCutcheon whiskey.
Ah.
FilmSchoolRejects.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Rejects. Don't forget to follow the show at Storm Podcast. And you can email us hosts@stormpodcast.com with all of the things I got wrong this month.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7D. You can find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast. And I'm, urging you to handle dynamite, carefully, but also when it's in your backpack, do not fall down.